This talk is one of hundreds of hours of leading Christian thinking. Go to www.euroleadershipresources.org and sign up to get our monthly email. More resources to support ministry are available to you now. The European Leadership Forum exists to connect local Christian leaders with God's global resources.
Well, we'll begin. There are a couple of others that may come in. So we're a small group. But if you're game, I'm game. My bus doesn't leave until 2 o'clock, so we might as well do something, right? About 2 years ago, Richard Swinburne and others paid tribute to Nicholas Wolterstorff, who was retiring from Yale University. And at that particular gathering, Swinburne gave his presentation, which is now a part of a book, I believe, about what were the percentages, the possibilities for the resurrection. I think he has it up somewhere around 93% and 97% probability for the resurrection. And there were a number of other papers that were being presented. And the New York Times, or one of the major newspapers, I'm not sure precisely which one, reported that gathering and commented on the different papers. And then, at the very end, said, but what was conspicuously absent from all the papers was that nobody dealt with the most difficult issue for Christianity, namely the problem of evil. As you probably all know, last year, Anthony Flew publicly declared that he was now no longer an atheist, but he was a theist. And he says, but I am not a revelatory theist. That is, I'm not a Christian. And the reason? The problem of evil. In 9/11, after 9/11, many of us heard Christians go to the airwaves as they were being interviewed, as people were trying to make sense out of two seemingly conflicting notions. For a long time, at least in America, there had been this desire to do away with God. We didn't need him, we'd outgrown him, and we did not any longer wish to think that there was such a thing as evil in the world. But after 9/11, they recognized that, yes, there is evil, and almost out of necessity, we really do need to have God, because things are just too unstable. So many of the news media went to the chief speakers of Christianity or religion, and as you know, everybody was being interviewed. Why would God allow something like 9/11? And if you listened to that, you heard a variety of responses. And I will probably mention some of them a little bit later. And then, of course, last year, the end of last year, the tsunami in Southeast Asia. And I was on my way to speak. I was teaching in Malaysia for the month of January. So I never did get a chance to sit and listen to a complete report as to what were the different Christians saying. But actually, in Malaysia, I was reading articles. And as they tried to respond to the question, why the tsunami? Why would God permit the tsunami? And there's just a variety of, I would think, rather unconvincing responses. And it seems like every time you picked up the paper, somebody else had a new idea as to why it might be that God would permit the tsunami. Well, all of those, and in particular, the 9/11, what what amazed me is that for the first about 2 weeks, America, and I think much of the Western world at least, was very interested in finding out, was there an answer from the Christian community that made sense? And I think that the community of the world as a whole concluded that Christians do not have an answer because they stopped asking the question. And I don't think it was because they had received an answer. It's just because they thought there isn't an answer. And they went back to this notion, well, we'll do it ourselves. So we had such little mantras as united, we stand, together we'll rebuild. But God was no longer a part of this equation. Why? Church attendance, as you may know, right after 9/11, I think the first week went up considerably. But after that, it dropped right back down to the same level. I understand, though I have not read this, I understand that George Bonner, you may have heard of him, he's a pollster, has written a number of books, he's a Christian, and a well-respected pollster. I have been told that he has reported that there was no significant or measurable impact evangelistically because of what happened in 9/11. And yet many Christians wanted to say, well, this is God waking up America. Now, what really perplexed me was that some of the statements that were made during that time and some of the statements that were made about the tsunami went along the lines of God was judging America. Well, God was judging America for abortion and for some of her other sins, like homosexuality. Well, I thought it was rather strange that God would strike New York if he was going for the homosexual community. I would have chosen the West Coast, not the East Coast. And I don't think there were any abortion clinics, to the best of my knowledge, operating in the trade towers. So it seems to me that that kind of an explanation, not only does it tend to be somewhat arrogant that we know when God judges. I'm not saying that God doesn't judge, don't misunderstand me. I'm just saying I don't know how you know in this day and age if that's what's happening. So after all this, you do know or maybe do not know that some of the people who made those statements, some of the great leaders of Christianity who made those statements, actually went back on the air within 4 or 5 days and retracted their statement. Well, maybe that wasn't why it happened. Which, of course, does nothing more than cause confusion in the mind of the world, who's looking for some sort of a direct and reasonable answer as to why is it that things like this happen. And I had did interviews and people asking the question. I think the community, the world community as a whole, simply did not receive a legitimate answer from the church. Nor did it receive a legitimate answer from the church during the days of the tsunami. And it was interesting that I was teaching on the problem of evil in Malaysia during that time. So it was a great opportunity. It was a great object lesson, if you please. Matter of fact, people had been killed just about 3 miles from where we were teaching. So we have had some opportunities to speak and to speak directly, but I think those opportunities have really been missed. Now, I am going to present to you a model, which I think, obviously I think it, or I wouldn't suggest it, that this has theological grounding, but I will just provide you the evidence and you make up your own mind whether or not this does provide a better answer than what has normally been given. I will confess to you that even though I have been studying these things for a number of years, and I can say with David, I was young and now I'm old, Even with all of that, I still would not say that I've understood everything perfectly. I confess with the Apostle Paul, I still see through a glass darkly. There are a lot of things that I really wish I had a better answer for. It's not that I don't have an answer. It's just that sometimes I feel, but I would like to have a stronger answer for this. Maybe if God gives me another 20 years, I will come to greater assurance in some of these areas. So I present these with what I would call an epistemological humility, but I do present them in a way that, can we just maybe just turn that off? Let me just work through your outline. Will be the easiest way for us to do this, and then we're small groups, so just any time you want to ask a question, we will have time for questions, but I really prefer if you have questions while I'm going through this, then I would like for you to ask any questions that you have. Now, what are the questions that we have? Well, there are, generally speaking, why does God allow so much suffering? Why does God not protect the children from terrible suffering? Could not God stop the worst of the evils in this world? Now, the evangelical community has been good at answering questions that nobody is asking, or giving answers to questions, but the answers they give do not correspond to the question that's been asked. And so someone says, well, I think the answer to this is, the real question is, why is there good and not evil? But that's not answering the question that is being asked by the world. The world is not asking why there is evil in the world. That they are more than willing to accept. What they want to know is, why is there so much intense evil, unequally distributed evil, and why is it that the innocent suffer? That's the question that the world wishes to have answered. We seldom address that question. The question before us is not how sin and evil got into the world. We know how that happened. It's, you know, by one man's disobedience, sin entered into the world. The Bible is clear on that. Now, what are some of the answers that have been traditionally given? One is that God will bring some good from this. And if you listen to people after 9/11 or after the tsunami, and I only pick out those two, but it is interesting, folks, that I very seldom see anybody trying to give an answer as to why the good comes out of so many children dying of starvation in certain African countries. I seldom see anybody giving an answer of the good that comes from all the people in Africa who are dying of AIDS. I don't hear anybody addressing that issue. We only come forward and say, well, when a tsunami or when the 9/11 or something like that, we try to establish that there is this, God allowed this to happen for some good. Now, for those of us who are committed to the God of the Bible, and I know that they're probably even in this room, that we do not all have our theology drawn out exactly the same way. I will admit that. And I'm not ashamed of my position any more than you're not ashamed of your position. But those of us who hold that God is the God of the universe, to us, I suppose, it would not make a lot of difference because we have such a strong commitment to God. And say, well, if God chooses to let this happen, he must have some good that's coming out of it. But stop and think, number one, what would have to be true in order for that, for you to be able to make that statement? And I suggest that either one or two things must be true if we are going to make the statement that God allowed the tsunami because from it he either was going to bring about a greater good or prevent a worse evil. Now, what would two things would be necessary for me to make that statement as a true statement? One, if I had a propositional statement in the Bible that said that all evil that takes place in this world is allowed by God in order that he might bring about a greater good. If there was a verse like that in the Bible, right, we wouldn't have to ask any questions. We would simply say, that's what it is. Or you had the evidence, that is, you could point to the evidence. Now, most people who hold what is called the greater good theodicy, the one that I've just stated, which has been from the time of Augustine, They do not point to a text of Scripture. They try to point to the evidence. And so, during the right after 9/11, as the church was trying to support this position that a greater good was brought from 9/11, they then tried to point to evidence that would support their claim. And so we would get statements like, there were three people who came to know Jesus. Well, let's see. 3,000 die, 33 people are saved. So how do you establish that three people being saved is a greater good than, let's say, 2,500 going to hell? I mean, I assume that that's about the percentages. I'm not trying to be God on this, and I didn't stand at the door of death and do a tally as people went this way and that way. But my suspicion is that given the general percentages of the relationship of believers to unbelievers in our culture, I would say that maybe 2,500 might have actually gone to hell. Well, let's just say I'm getting very conservative, and I say 2,000 people went to hell and 1,000 people went to heaven. But is that then sufficient to see 2,000 go to hell and three more people get saved? The other thing that I have a question about that is, we will discuss it, and I'm very open to discussing this, is how do you know that those three people would not have been saved anyway? What grounds do we have for affirming that they would not have been saved? That this was a necessary part in order to see that they would be saved. But we'll come back to this. But that's one answer. It's the more traditional answer. It is the more traditional answer. Let me just parenthetically say this. Augustine, who's desperately, as well as other church fathers, all the way up to the Reformation, desperately did everything they could to make sure that God was not responsible for evil. Now, that changed with the Reformation, because there was a shift in the Reformation and just a little bit prior to the Reformation, and probably under the influence of people like William of Ockham. But there are a couple of books that have documented this, and the two people who have written on this are Reformed theologians, and they say that there is a shift in the Reformation from the nature of God to the will of God, so that if God would will that evil would be a means to good, then that would be all right, even though the Bible says that in him is light and no darkness at all. It's a mystery. Some people just say, well, it's a mystery. And we don't know why. Now, we don't know why God does it. Now, let me be very clear about this. I am not saying that I know precisely why 9/11, all right? I'm not arguing for that. What I would argue is a paradigm that would make sense of why something like this could happen. I'm not trying to tell you detail, this is why God did it. I'm only saying I'm offering you a model or a paradigm by which we could say this happened in the broad sense, because in the world in which we live, this is the sort of thing that should not surprise us. Now, I really find it strange that evangelicals would say that there is no answer to questions coming out of the tsunami, 9/11, the Holocaust, and things like that, when in fact, what we boast of is a Christian worldview that is superior to every worldview and answers all the great questions of life. And then the big question comes down the pike and someone says, I don't really have an answer, it's a mystery. That's not much of an answer. God's knowledge does not extend into the future, therefore God does not know what man will do, and therefore he can't stop him before he does it. Of course, that's the openness view. That is, that God does not know the future, so he could not stop anybody prematurely. And then there's some actually would argue God is judging people for their disobedience to him. That actually happened in the tsunami, which was maybe even more well-publicized than 9/11. There was a gentleman who said, and he was... Well, he put his name to this, so I suppose I should not be ashamed of it. But Blackaby, you've heard of Blackaby, experience of God. He said the reason for the tsunami, he had taken out his map and he'd seen all the areas that had been hit by the tsunami. And he said that the tsunami was a judgment of God upon the Islamic countries for their abuse of Christians. Now, I just don't know how he had that kind of information. I just don't know where he got it, unless he wants to claim that he's a prophet. But even that, I guess, would not be a prophet. That would mean he could have told us before it happened. Here's somebody who's making this sort of a statement, and I'm asking you, on what grounds do you make this statement? What is the text that you point to? So those are some of the answers that have been given. Well, what should we do? Well, I say consider the Christian worldview, if it is really superior. Then I think we really do need to have an answer. Does that mean we have a full-blown answer? No. And does it mean we can answer every little detail? No. There are times when there are events, I should say, that say that there are two children in the back seat of an automobile. There's an accident. One is killed immediately and the other one walks away without a scratch. And you ask the question, why did that one die and this one live? And I tell you, I don't know. I don't know that question. But can I tell you why it is that something like that might happen and that it doesn't count against God? And I think, yes, I can do that, or at least should be able to do that. I would then argue this is not an academic issue. It's a pastoral issue in the main. Now, I've debated atheists, and this has been brought up. And I don't mind debating the atheist on this issue. But I would say most of us are concerned with answering this question pastorally in two ways. One, the people in our churches who are hurting, who encounter this sort of a thing, and they come to us for answers. Or we are out witnessing to the person on the street and the objection is raised, I wouldn't believe in God because of the problem of evil. Now, how many of you, when you have witnessed, how many of you, in speaking to others about Christ, have had a person say to you, in one way or another, my objection to Christianity is, and they state the problem of evil in some way. Yeah, that's right. It's, you know, my grandfather died before he got to see his grandson, or, you know, why did this good person down the street die? And why I can't understand a God like that. And why did God take my child when he was only 3 years of age? I mean, you've heard it pronounced in different ways, but it all is this same issue. What do we say to these people? Do we simply say to them, now, dearie, it's a mystery and we don't know, but we'd like to have you believe in Jesus? Or could we say to them, now, dearie, God did that, but we'd really like you to come to this God of love and trust him as your Savior. Well, if I just told a person that God did it, it was his will that it happened, it doesn't seem to me that that's a very open invitation to embrace this God for your salvation, because he now seems to me to be somewhat like a witch doctor. I never know if he's going to heal me or kill me. And I should, you know, I maybe overstate my case, but it does seem to me to be an issue that we have to deal with. Now, what we call these things is a theodicy. I'm sure you've heard of that term. And a theodicy is simply an attempt to explain the ways of God to man in reference to the existence of evil in this world. I don't care about the next point. This is just a point that a difference that I make in academics. When I am arguing or debating with someone on the problem of evil, I never permit them to call it the problem of evil. To me, that immediately prejudices my case. It's an argument from evil, that's all. Not the problem of evil. You've got the problem. I don't have the problem. So let's not call it the problem of evil. Let's just call it an argument from evil. You may be aware, those of you who've done any study of Aquinas, when he wanted to deal with the problem of evil, or the argument from evil, he got it right when he said, well, the first thing I need to do is to find out what are the arguments for God's existence. And then we'll look at what is the argument against his existence, namely the problem of evil. Now, as an unbeliever, as an unbeliever, if we can think that way for a moment, would you think that the argument from evil, or let's put it this way, the presence of evil in a world that is maintained by an all-powerful, all-knowing, omnibenevolent God is something hard to understand and could literally be a legitimate objection. See, I think it is, if I think as an unbeliever. How many of you were unbelievers until the age you were 20? Yeah, okay, so I'd say most of you got into the kingdom earlier, but I was an unbeliever for 20 years. And so maybe I have an understanding of how unbelievers think. Of course, I've been engaged with unbelievers for years as well, but I know from my own personal experience. Now, this is an interesting question, and since this is not videoed, and it will be a silent indication, so no one will know how you voted on this. But have you, as a Christian, ever wrestled with this issue and asked it? Yeah, exactly. And I, as you know, I was a pastor. I've been a pastor since 1968. So I stopped doing that about the year 2001, 2002. So about 30, 35 years, I served as a pastor. I simply say I served as a pastor. I don't know if I was one or not, but I served as one. I got into the pulpit every Sunday and tried to do something that sounded like preaching. Then I found this lovely group of people that were so gracious. They felt maybe some sort of a responsibility to the rest of the Christian community, and they just let me stay in their church for the 21 years and kept me from, inflicting anybody else with my poor preaching. But during that time, I think I've encountered almost every kind of evil in the sense of the things that really rattle us. You know, the baby dying, the husband of a few children or small children being killed, taking his own life. I mean, down the line. And, you know, when you deal with these people, at first they're really not usually asking questions. They just want you to hug them, weep with them, pray with them. But I will tell you that sooner or later the questions will come, and that's when we need to have the answers. Someone said, well, I don't need to have all this stuff. I don't need to have a theodicy. That's not, a person doesn't want to hear about a theodicy. And I say, you're precisely right. But I would use the illustration something like this. I hope this is not true of any of you. But if you had cancer, would you not go to an oncologist? That is, a person who was specialized in cancer. Sure. Now, when you go into his office, do you want him to tell you the pathology of cancer, or do you simply want him or her to give you the treatment plan that's going to restore you to health? Which one are you looking for? Treatment. Yeah, you're looking for the treatment, but can he give you a good treatment plan if he does not know the pathology of cancer? And I'm saying that's the same with us as Christian leaders in the church. We need to have a good understanding. Let's call it the pathology of evil. It doesn't mean that when somebody comes in that we're going to say, now I need to tell you something. Let's go through these definitions. You've got to get this right. No. But if we have a good theodicy ourselves, we work out of that to give these people the very thing they need to bring them the kind of understanding and comfort and healing that's necessary for their lives. So I want to make it clear the role that I see a theodicy playing. And sometimes a theodicy, well, let me put it this way. A theodicy, folks, not only helps us to say the right things, but it keeps us from saying the wrong things. And that's equally as important. Too many people have been given bad counsel in times of grief, in times of suffering. So we don't only want to say the right thing, we want to keep from saying the wrong thing. We know, what is the question? We use the word evil in a broad sense to mean suffering in general, not exclusively in the theological sense, though it includes that. Usually in the discussion we talk about the problem of evil or the argument from evil, it's thinking about the argument from suffering. But is it not so? It seems to me, at any rate, that all suffering in this world is a result of sin. Maybe not personal sin, but just because we live in a fallen place. My understanding is that if there would not have been the fall in the garden, and had it been possible that everybody did the right thing, then there would be no suffering in this world. There would be no evil in this world, theological evil. There is what we call, we often break evil into three different categories: natural, moral, and physical, though that may not include everything. And natural evil is like the tsunami, moral evil is like lying, killing, and physical evil would be things like heart attacks, disease, and that nature. Now, the question of evil's presence is clearly answered in the Bible, and we don't need to go over that. Now, a theodicy should not merely undercut the argument from evil. Actually, that is a misprint, and I bear total responsibility for that. And we should simply say that a theodicy is not merely to counterbalance the argument from evil. It should seek to defeat it. Now, that's a personal position for me. Alvin Plantinga, who I have great respect for, would say that all we need to do is to demonstrate a position where it just simply counterbalances the problem of evil. All right? So that you don't move forward at all, but you just simply say, well, I'm as well off as you are. The person says, well, you know, there's no God because, and Plantinga says, well, but you, I'm going to give you a position, and I'm going to say that even in light of evil, I am just as rational for believing there is a God as you are for believing there is not a God. Now, I think that has its place, but personally for me, I would like to move beyond that. I would actually like to have a theodicy that defeats the argument from evil. So, the question that plagues the hearts is why this all-loving, all-powerful, all-knowing God allows the terrible evils to continue. Much of the Bible, relatively speaking, narrates this problem, but makes few instructive propositional statements regarding some of our most difficult questions. Now, let's just take a moment and think about some of the events in the Bible that deal with this issue, and what does it say? So think of some narrative where we have suffering, evil going on, and what the Bible says about it. So what are some of those scenarios, those narratives that we have in the Bible?
Joseph.
All right, Joseph. And what statement? We have a number of chapters, right, that sort of follow the story of Joseph, right? Now, all the while that story is unfolding, are there any propositional statements during the time it's happening that tells us why it's happening? I mean, from God's perspective.
No.
All we know, we just said, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened. Now, you don't get any kind of a statement until what point? That's right. It's afterwards, isn't it? Genesis 50:20. It's after this whole thing has run its course, and Joseph has kind of come out on the upside of this thing. He's had his little fun with his brothers, made them sweat a little bit, and now he finally reveals himself, and he says, don't worry. And obviously, you know what they were thinking, right? This is payback time. Payback time. And Joseph says what to them?
You intended it for good, but God particularly preferred it. You intended it for evil, but God worked it for good.
Right. You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. Now, that is a statement. Would we not call that a testimony on Joseph's part? Is that not what that is? That's a testimony. Is it a testimony before the fact or after the fact? It's after the fact. We will talk about that a little bit. But I think we need to make these distinctions. That's what I would call a reflective testimony, not a prophetic testimony. Be very careful about taking a reflective testimony and applying it as a prophetic testimony. So you find somebody who's in a similar situation, and then you use the reflective testimony to go and comfort them and say, oh, this is what God is going to do for you. That becomes a prophetic testimony. Yes?
You mean that Joseph came with his kind of perspective and his interpretation to what had happened. It's not what God is kind of interpreting.
Yeah, the question is, was this just Joseph's interpretation or was this God's?
Yes.
I think it was God's, okay?
On what basis?
Well, only that I would say this, that what it seems to be that since Joseph is very much involved with God, God has worked in his life and everything, I think it is reasonable for me to conclude that this is what God was doing. In fact, there's another statement in the Bible later on in that text which seems to indicate Joseph got it right. But I think that is probably because Joseph had, if you please, maybe even inside information from God. I mean, is not Joseph very much in touch with God all through this? So, but your question raises a really good issue here. And how do we know? We can only just take it on inference that Joseph is right on this. But the most this tells us is what? This was only true for whom?
Joseph.
Yeah, it only tells us it was true for Joseph, right?
Yes.
Right. It does not say, Joseph does not quote a propositional statement from the Bible and say, oh, by the way, didn't you read this over here? God said this would always be the case. So even if we grant that Joseph is right on this, it's still only for Joseph. In no way can we have, it seems to me, we have no real grounds for making this a normative statement for everybody. Now, does somebody else have a question? Okay. All right. But we'll come back to that. Well, who else do you think of?
David.
All right, David. All right. In what case with David?
Suffering under Saul's persecution.
Oh, all right. And does at any point do we have any statement from David or anybody around David that says, oh, this was all allowed because God is going to bring some greater good out of it? Do we ever find any kind of a statement like that in any of that?
Not during the event.
No. Do you have any time where you have an interpretation of the event that lays it out in that case? Yeah, they might find something in the Psalms, and I have to confess, nothing comes to my mind right now, but that doesn't mean it's not there, since I have not committed it all to memory. But there's nothing that stands out to us, is there? It just, now, do we see things working out in the end for David? Yeah, but that's only because we have a record. But there's no statement in a very general or a normative way, all right? What about, who else might you think of? A whole book.
Job,
all right? Now, Job is a very interesting one. Why does Job suffer?
There is many hints in the Bible, but it's still...
Yeah. All right, to give glory to God. What's this one over here?
Because of the Satan. That's the introductory explanation.
It seems to me quite clear that is the explanation, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Now, what is the problem here?
Why does God allow that?
Yes, but what? Right, but what is the problem? Why is it? What's this? Yeah, poor Job. You know, we know, but you know, we get the introduction to the text. But poor Job, this guy doesn't have the privilege of this information. But if you read the first couple, well, the first chapter enough, let's eliminate some things. I often hear people say that Job, that God needed to get rid of some sin in Job's life. But that doesn't sound, that doesn't seem to square, does it? What's the Bible say about Job? He's a righteous man, and what does he do? He eschews the great thundering diction of the King James. He shuns evil. He's upright in all of his ways. I wouldn't mind having God write that on my headstone. Don't worry, it won't appear. Not on mine. Three times in the first two chapters, that is reaffirmed. It seems to me that we know why Job suffers. It's because of a much larger issue. In fact, it has very little to do with Job. What is the accusation? Since he is such a righteous man, what's the accusation from the adversary?
That God is protecting him.
And that's why, that's right. That God has protected him, and that's why he's such a good boy. In other words, after all, of course Job loves you. Look at all you do for him. And that's the mighty question from the angelic perspective. Do men love God because he is God, or do men love God because he does good things for them? That's a mighty question, isn't it? And it's being asked from the adversary who's already got his dues for not loving God, right? And now you have a being less than him, a human being, who is accounted as one of these that love God, and Satan is saying, yeah, right. But if you had done for him what you do, if you'd done for me what you've done for him, maybe I wouldn't have fallen too. I mean, I'm kind of ad-libbing there, but that's the issue. So when the whole thing plays out, what is the final answer? Do men love God? Well, at least did Job love God simply because of what God did for him? Is that why he loved God?
No.
And is it proven out?
Yes.
So the whole book of Job is a very interesting study in itself, but I don't think it yields the kind of information that people think it yields in the problem of suffering, simply because this is a unique kind of suffering for a very unique cosmic question. Do I think that people suffer today because of satanic or evil forces? Yes, I do. But not as Job suffered. The question is settled as far as I can see it. That Job settled the question. You know.
In that example, I have had someone, well, that proves that men are not free. Because God and Satan are playing with human beings as hearts. And the answer is no. In fact, Job had all options before him to choose whatever he wanted to do. And he decided to stick with God.
Yes. That's right. The idea being that people might say that this kind of shows determinism. Mm-hmm. But in fact, it reveals really the opposite, does it not? You're right. Because it's, does man choose to love God because of the benefits he gets? Or does he really just choose to love God? And the answer is, he chooses to love God. Good. So, you see, when you start going to the Bible and trying to find answers, it gets somewhat difficult. I think that we'll, as we look through this, I'm not convinced there's anything in the Bible that says that God allows all the suffering in this world, or let me put it this way, God allows only that evil in this world from which he can bring about a greater good or prevent a worse evil. How would you know the latter part? How would you know if he prevented a worse evil? I don't know how you'd know that. That's what we call a counterfactual, right? You can't know what, you know, somebody says, well, if I would have married Irene, I would have been happier. And I say, well, why do you believe that? Well, look, Andre married Irene, and he's really happy. And I say, yes, but if you married Irene, you might both have been miserable. You don't know these things. I mean, counterfactuals. So,
if we do know that God's works are perfect, what's the distinction you're making there?
That God's words are perfect.
Works.
Yes, that God's works are perfect. And the question is?
You're saying the same propositional statement that everything he does is good.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So now notice what that requires. That would require us then to also conclude that everything that happens on this earth is God's doing.
Yeah.
If that would be the case, is that where we would want to go? That would be my next question. Once you say that, we would have to take everything that happens that's evil or suffering, right? So if everything that happens on this earth is God's work directly, then we'd have to say it's perfect, there's no question. But I would raise a concern as to whether or not that is in fact the way God has arranged things, that there are some things that happen on this earth that are the choice of man because God has given him that, and it is not the direct work of God, such as killing somebody, committing adultery, lying.
So his work is perfect in the sense that it was perfectly right for him to let us get on with doing
that? Well, that would, yes, absolutely. And where he does intervene, that work is always perfect. Like the cross on Calvary. I'm not saying that's the only one, but I do think, you know, God providentially intervenes. Whenever we find God intervening, when we look at God's overall plan, when we see how God is structured, yes, that I would say is perfect. I have no right to complain. When God raises up one man and puts down another, that's God's perfect work, I have no.
What about Romans 8?
Uh-huh.
I mean, thinking particularly for Christians, because, you know, all things work together
mm-hmm.
for good for those that love God.
Yes. Yeah, the question is, what about Romans chapter 8, verse 28? For we know that all things work together for good to them that love God and those who are called according to his purpose. Well, and then you very wisely qualify that and say, the most we could say about that is for those who love God.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't be sufficient for a theodicy, would it?
That's
right.
True, yeah.
But it right.
It's pastorally, it might be
worth. Yes. Yes. And then I wasn't even going to take it one step further. If we could, we'll get to that, all right? But let me just say at this point, I think if we look at that text exegetically, all of Romans 8, I think you'll conclude that suffering, when all things is only suffering for righteousness' sake, only for righteousness.
Yeah, it is.
And that then seems to square with what Jesus said, what Peter says, what James says. But it is the text that's often just very broadly applied out there to Christians. And I'm saying, I think we need to be careful. Good. Therefore, like other great doctrines of the Bible, we must look at the whole of the text and develop a theodicy from inference, which is consistent with what the Bible affirms and doesn't affirm what the Bible denies. Now, do we build other doctrines from inference? Can you think of a doctrine that is important to us that we build from inference? That is, there is not a propositional statement in the Bible that says da-da-da-da-da. The Trinity is, do we think that the, well, I don't know. I'm assuming that we think the Trinity is not a suspicious doctrine. But isn't it built by inference?
It is clearly implied.
Yes. What we have is, do we have any statement in the Bible that says there are only three persons in the Trinity?
No.
No. Nope.
But it's not saying just only, but it says three persons.
Yeah.
It doesn't mention about their name, and they name it.
Yeah. That's right. So, somebody said, well, then why are you limited to three? Well, because only three are ever mentioned, right? Why would we go beyond the scope of Scripture? If three are mentioned, then let's go with three. It's, but it is a theology that's built from inference. There's nothing wrong with that. But when we build from inference, we must be careful. And I always say to my students, never try to do your theology in a closet. That is, just by yourself. Because the only questions you will ask of the text are the questions that are important to you. And those may not be the only questions that need to be asked of the text. So we need one another. And so every time I get a chance to present this sort of thing, I'm always open to criticism, of course, in the spirit of Christ, and say, you haven't covered this. You missed this. Because there maybe is something I've missed, okay? And it needs to be dealt with if we're going to offer something that's legitimate. I'm not interested in preserving a system. I'm interested in the truth. And it takes all of us working together meaningfully to arrive at that when we are working with inferential. Truth is not only to be believed, it's to be communicated, and our responsibility is to do it accurately. Theological error tends to increase as Christian theological vigor decreases. And I sense theological vigor has decreased in the evangelical community over the last 50 years at least. It really, I don't think that's just a statement we put out there. I don't make that statement casually. It just seems to me that's the case. Most of our people in the churches are not only are they theologically illiterate, they're biblically illiterate. They don't even know often what's in the Bible. And we have this notion that people can't take doctrine. You know, we just have to kind of give them milk, you know, and keep them happy and keep them giving money and keep them coming back. Because, you know, we wouldn't want anybody to think that we weren't doing our job if the church wasn't full. And there's plenty of pressure. I know all about that. Let's look at some definitions. I know I'd done this in another course, in another time, but I think it's wise for us because to do it again, as not everybody has done this with me. Now, sovereignty. I've taken some language, some theological terms that are generally used in this discussion. Now, I have already given a definition somewhat of sovereignty. But I would ask for your definition. Maybe you think mine's not very good. Do you think that God is sovereign? No. Yes? No question there. But then what raises the question is, what do we mean by sovereignty? All right, okay. God has the right to do what he wants to do, governed by who he is. Right.
Yeah, right. God does what he wants to do.
Okay, all right, all right, all right, okay.
His choice is kind of free from, you know, many things
yeah.
what we're going to imagine.
Yeah, All right, good. His choices are free in that no one tells God what to do. God is never forced into anything, I think, anything. I'm not here to debate or to challenge or to criticize. I'm with Augustine and with Aquinas. I don't think God was necessarily bound to save anybody. I don't think he was. I think he chooses to do that, but as you've indicated, he's free. Anybody else?
He's not accountable to anyone.
All right, he's not accountable to anyone but himself. All right, good.
There's a distinction between his perfect will and his permissive will.
Well, we can talk about that a little bit, and I'll be happy to do that, the distinction between perfect and permissive. So let's hold that just a second. Are we going to be satisfied with the notion of what we're going to use for sovereignty? Okay. Now, what we have to be careful about here is the different ways in which the word will is used. So I'm going to let you define what you mean by will. Do you mean plan?
Yes.
Okay. I'm not trying to force you into anything. I'm not trying to force you to anything. But, okay. Here's some over here. Okay. So, this idea that we have a permissive will, right? Or perfect will. And I'm just going to put this down here and you tell me if this shows the right relationship as you understand it. And this is the permissive will. Would that accurately represent what you say? It'd be one way. I'm not saying it's your way, but would this be your way of representing these two?
I suppose if pressed, I would make permissive will a subset.
All right.
Actually,
uh-huh. Okay.
I've not kind of done this before. So it may not work out.
Oh, well. Okay. If we you know, would this be more right for you?
I think so.
So the perfect will includes the possibility of the permissive will.
Yeah.
Okay.
I would put actually in the core what I call God's wish as opposed to God's planning will, which... So in the core, I would put the heart of God. And then as extension, which implies that...
this is what God wishes?
God replies on evil. Yeah, it would be wish. That's what God wishes. And uh-huh. Then around it would be God's plan. So will. Which is also perfect. All God's will would be perfect. But God's will for Jesus to die on the cross was his perfect will. But it was not his wish. God suffered. The Father suffered when Son died, but it was will of God, and it was perfect will of God.
Okay.
But it was not His wish.
All right. So you would want to say, all right. So you want to make a distinction between God's desire,
yes,
and God's plan.
Exactly.
Okay.
God does things that hurt Him.
Okay. Now what this now begins to show is that we use the word will in different ways. What 1 Peter 3, what is it, 3:7 says, and God is not willing that any should perish. Well, that certainly can't be his plan, because if it were his plan, what would be the case?
No one would perish.
No one would perish. But does it seem to be his desire that no one perish? Yeah. Well, I think you're right, but let's... So having said that, let's come to this diagram here. If this is what you mean, that is that God's permissive will and his perfect will, and his permissive will is inside the perfect will. This comes back to what the gentleman just said here, where he said that God, one of God's perfect wills is that he gives us some realm of choice. All right. Now, here's what I would say. I understand the concept and would be in agreement with this. I think we should find better words to use. I think the word will, used in this way, immediately begins to confuse, because it appears that God is some kind of, in some way, schizophrenic, that he has two wills. But surely God does not have two wills. God can only have one will.
Does he have a character and a plan to act? So could we say that 2 Peter 3:9 is referring to his character? His character is not that people should perish.
Yes.
Uh-huh. So we can talk about his character.
Yeah. Well, what you're trying to get at, you're saying, well, maybe we can work with his character. I don't know what the best words are. At this point in time, I have some ideas, but all I would like for us to do, at least today, is to realize that we need to be very careful. We talk about perfect will and permissive will. If we represent it, if we're thinking like this, that it's two separate things. If it is that, it creates real confusion. And I would say, if it's like this on the left-hand side, then I would then ask the next question, which seems to happen more often, the perfect will or the permissive will? I think we'd all agree that the permissive will seems to happen more. That scares me just a little bit. Okay? So, but if we put it inside of here, and then we might just use some different language. That's what I would like to do. But if we can just understand, this is what we're talking about. All right?
Trying to put it into concepts that non-Christians can understand. I think people would be familiar with the idea that you can have a good man who lets bad things happen. So you can have a good headmaster who has good rules in his school and is by nature good, but still lets people make their free choice.
Yes, precisely. Yes. I often use things like this. Let's suppose that you are my... This uses kind of the same, at least in the same area that you're talking about. Let's say that you were my students, and you came into my class, and I gave you what we call a syllabus, the rules of the game. This is what you must do in order to get to pass my class. Now, do you have the choice to pass my class or not pass it? Sure. Do you have the choice whether to do one assignment or not do it? Sure. But will there be consequences? So I'm the one who can establish, as it were, the rules, but those rules give you some kind of freedom that you can make choices. But it don't determine. If you want to pass my course, then you will have to follow the rules. Well, this will help us, and I don't want to take too much time on it, but just to get us to start thinking about how easily we just throw these terms around, and yet many people have not thought about how do I define them. And that's where most of the discussion begins to generate, in those discussions that create more heat than light. Omnipotence, I think that's a pretty clear one, right? That is God's absolute perfection and power and perfection, extent, and degree. His omniscience. Now, I hold that God knows all things, past, present, and future. We won't get into this, but I also believe that God has middle knowledge. But
middle knowledge.
But we will. Well, that might come. That will come up.
Okay.
All right. The providence. I understand providence. Many people say appeal to the sovereignty of God when things happen. I would much better prefer to use the word providence. From my understanding, sovereignty is about the creative works and the establishment of things. That is, God in his sovereignty has established things the way they are. But now it's his providence that works within that order on a day-to-day basis. Now, there's another term that I want to use here because it will become, it's important, And that is the word world. Now, that is not in your notes, but at least so that you know how I'm using the word world. And I'm, by that, I'm not talking about using the word world as used in, let's say, John 3:16, for God so loved the world. We know that's not talking about the material matter, though it may include that. We seem to think Christ died for man. That's what it's talking about. I take world to be everything from creation. Just let me call it regeneration. That's what the world is. This is, heaven is not a world. Heaven is just another phase of this world. It is interesting in the Greek text, in the New Testament, that the word world is often translated, the word is translated world, but more often than not, it is not world, it's age. The Bible says in 2 Corinthians chapter 4 that he is the God of this age. It's been translated in some translation, world. No, it's age. Now, why do I make this point? And this has come up from some of the discussions that I've heard in other workshops this week. I think there is continuity between what God did in Genesis 1 and 2 all the way through to the final end of things. Now, we've heard that there's going to be a whole new creation and a new world. I understand that's a position. It's not my position. I take Psalm 104, verse 5 says that the foundations of the earth are forever.
What about when Peter says that the elements are
dissolved? Yes, yes. I think there is a...
That's regeneration.
Yes, that's right. It's not... I don't take it... I take God when he rested on the seventh day. I take that a complete rest. That God does no new creation from that day forward. I know that's debatable, but I'm just letting you know where I'm coming from.
And then you would believe that we're still kind of God still on this seventh day.
Yes. 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 I believe that God is still in this seventh day, yes. I think that's why we have the virgin birth rather than God just creating a new Adam, which would have done the same thing. But God works within the order that he has established. I realize that there are differences on this, but I'm just trying to be fair to you and letting you know this is where I'm coming from. And so when I make the statement, this is the best of all possible worlds, understand that I'm using the word world, what God did on the day of creation, and all the way through up to regeneration, the eternal state, whatever that's going to be called. I am of the opinion that what God did in Genesis 1 and 2 could never be perfected. It's the best. Now, not everybody's going to agree to that.
But you're using the concept of Leibniz.
Yes, I am.
That would somehow imply that inference of evil, breaking of evil into God's creation is also part of creation, and that it's something that God needed for making the whole world the best of the possible.
Right. Yeah. That this seems to make evil necessary to the plan of God.
Just part of
Yeah. And I would argue it's just the other way around. Mm-hmm. I think this is the only way to get out of the end being that God needed evil to accomplish something. There are those who say that God needed evil to do something better than what he did by direct creation.
I'm aware that you're actually against this
argument. Yeah. Yes. And I think that this argument... All we are saying here is, I'm going to use this term because we're all familiar with it, free will. I hate the term, simply because it's a misnomer. Nobody has free will. None of you are free in absolute sense, are you? No. Are not your choices today somewhat predicated upon choices that you made yesterday and the day before that? Have not events in your life shaped your choices for today? So I'm just saying we're not free, but let me use the term because we understand it, but if you'll understand it in that way. Power of moral choice.
No, I know, but I guess meant that it's a word that doesn't mean what it says. You called it...
a misnomer.
Misnomer,
right. It's attaching.
M-E-R.
Yeah, it's...
Misnomer, wrongly named.
Wrongly named. Thank you. You do better in your English than I do, see? thank you. I'm going to take you with me. yeah, that's right. I always thought I spoke the King's English, but so just for our understanding, this is why I say it's the best of all possible worlds. Possible, see, if man is to have some power of choice under those conditions, this is the best of all possible worlds. Not that it was that sin was needed, but it was a possibility if man is going to have the power of choice. But I will think we'll get to that more in detail. But I think it's important for you to know that when I say this is the best of all possible worlds, I'm not talking about this moment I'm living in right now. I can think of ways of fixing this world a little bit better.
Could we go world well, use the word creation because it's slightly more familiar? People often mean creation. To
yes. Excuse me, I'm sorry.
Just using the word creation of the world might be a bit more familiar to people.
Yeah, you mean just using the word creation? Did you say?
Yeah. This creation.
You're right. The idea is we could just use the word this creation, but there are those who think that there's another creation after this.
Okay.
And I would say no. I mean, yeah. I would just love to enter in a discussion on that, but that's my only problem. That's the only problem with saying that. Providence, divine counsel, those events God has determined beforehand regarding the flow and the unfolding of history in the time of created order. Does it seem to be very clear that God has determined certain things in created order? Isaiah 44 through 46. I don't know what all those things are, but I do know they're there. Has he determined the end of all things? Yes. I answered my own question before I gave you an answer. No chance. Good. Absolutely speaking, that which flows from the nature of God who is light. God is not the author or the source of evil. God has all positive qualities in an infinite degree. I hold to most perfect being theology, what we call maximal perfection. Any attribute God has, he holds them in maximal perfection. And I hold to a classical view of God, omniscience, omnipresence, omnipotence, etc. Evil in practice, broadly speaking, that which is contrary to God or his order. Evil in principle, a privation or deviation from the good. I think we need to see both of those. Suffering evil. Evil is not used purely in the theological sense. Suffering. That which causes discomfort, pain, disquietness. I'm sure that you could put more things on this. But we all know what suffering is, right? Now, we shouldn't try to define suffering by what suffering might accomplish. See?
So you would put in this category of suffering of penalty, justice is no evil, what Peter says in 1 Peter 4, verse 14.
Yeah. Yes, I think that's important. Why would I want to make sure that I made it clear that not all suffering is evil? Why would... Why would we want to be clear that all suffering is not evil?
It was a cross.
All right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or what about God disciplining his children? Absolutely. We wouldn't want to call that evil, would we? No. But does it come about because of evil?
Yeah.
Yes. But it isn't evil. So I hope I'm not making distinctions too finely here. But I think this is how we need to do theology, is to make sure that we get as well defined as we can without becoming overburdensome in the process.
But in a sense, I perceive the suffering,
yes,
as whole. Mm-hmm. A call and a way to approach the cross, mm-hmm, and God's salvation. And for me, it's quite difficult to make this distinction between the evil that's justice. Obviously, I understand the concept.
Yes.
You know, I find hard to believe, to put in practice that, if that makes sense.
Yes.
Because even the evil that comes from the evil,
yes,
the suffering that comes from the evil, I find that it sometimes leads to God.
Yeah. Yeah. But you're right. The idea is that sometimes suffering, evil, leads to God. But remember now, we are not trying to, we don't want to define evil or suffering in what it may accomplish, but what it is in principle, what it is in fact, say. I think that's a big mistake, not your mistake, but it's a big mistake of Christians often. They say, well, good came out of it, therefore it wasn't evil. I say, no, wait a minute. That's crazy. Well, I'm sorry. That's an overstatement on my part and very unacademic and non-pastoral, okay? But that doesn't make sense to me. Okay. So, good. Pain and suffering... let me just come back. You raised the issue about evil or suffering with justice. Nobody in the debate ever raises the question or objection that an evildoer might suffer because of justice. That, they think, is quite reasonable. But what they don't think is right, as you can see now how this works, is when somebody who doesn't seem to deserve it seems to get clobbered, you know, by God, in fact, is what it seems to be. And let's be something, I want to be so clear about this as well. Do we think that all evil that is in this world is allowed by God? Yes. I don't think I don't know how we can get away from that. It is allowed by God. The question is, what is God's moral justification for allowing it? See, that seems to me to be the elephant that must be removed from the room. And, you know, the whole issue of evil is like, you know, getting a tiger by the tail. It's a big, big issue. And someone once told me, if you grab a tiger by the tail, you ought to have a plan for letting go. And so I have a plan for letting go. Evil, as used in the discussion, pain and suffering can be used to warn us that something is wrong, right? Is that not true? Let's say that I have a pain in my side. It may alert me that I have appendicitis. In that sense, is it good? Yes. So some people say, see, evil and pain are really necessary. But only if you get to pick the illustration. What about the person who has cancer? He has the pain. Now, he doesn't need the pain to continue to know that he has cancer. He doesn't need to get the pain to continue. He's in therapy. So why does the pain continue? Always remember, it's easy to use illustrations if you get to pick which illustrations. I've often said, I can answer any question in the world as long as you let me make up the question. Sure. Sure, that's easy, see? That's how we often do our theology. That's how we often do our arguments. We get to make up our own illustrations. Well, of course, I'm going to make up an illustration that supports my point of view. We probably need to take a break. Would a quarter after be okay? Another 5 minutes? Yeah, okay. Evil, as used in the discussion, goes beyond the intention of the perpetrator of the evil. This is another issue that I often hear raised to me and said, well, evil is based upon the intention of the person. And I'm going to say, if you hold to that view, it seems to me it's going to create a real problem for you with your ethics. If intention is what makes something good or evil, then I could do a very bad thing, but if my intention was good, then it must be good. See, because some people tell me, I say, well, a fireman rushes into a fire and saves a young child from death. Is that good or evil? I've had many people tell me that's not good. And I say, why? And they say, because the intention of the man saving the child was to bring glory to himself. And I think that's a stretch, folks. And probably not in the right direction either. Often a person may not intentionally think to do harm to another, and so it is not evil in the theological sense, but it's still evil in the sense of being used in our discussion. If I walk past you and I unintentionally stick my elbow in your eye, does that in any fashion lessen the suffering? Now, would we say that it has something to do with in what sense I am culpable for punishment? Yes, it has to do with why I might be punished and how I might be punished. Don't we have the cities of refuge, for example, in the Old Testament, right? Somebody who kills another person unintentionally. Was there still suffering there? Surely. But did we treat that person differently than the person who intentionally kills somebody? Yeah, intentionality doesn't have to do with suffering. It has to do with what penalty might be entailed in an act that causes suffering. And then the greater good theodicy, and that is simply stated, God allows only that evil into this world for which he can bring about a greater good or prevent a worse evil. And this was put forth by Augustine. And they ask Augustine, well, what about... First of all, Augustine built his theodicy on what's called a free will defense. And that is, he said, it was better for man to have power of choice than for man not to have power of choice. And his illustration was, it's better to have a runaway horse than a stone. But then, once sin entered the world, Augustine then had another theodicy, which said, God allows the evil in this world, only that evil, from which he can bring about a greater good or prevent a worse evil. And someone asked, well, what about a family, a mom and dad that lose a child? What is the good that comes from that? And Augustine said that they'll make them better parents. Is that always the case, folks? Is it always the case that evil always makes people better? Have you been in the church long enough? How many of you are pastors or serve in the church and pastors? Okay. But if you've had an experience in the Christian community, have you ever known of anybody who suffered? Let's just say, I'm just going to pick something, but you can plug in whatever you want. Somebody who lost a child early in life. Maybe the child was 5 years old. Have you ever known somebody that became bitter and angry at God because of that? A Christian, I'm talking about. And never wanted to come back to church. In counseling, we say it makes you either bitter or better. And many people, I have to confess, over the years of my ministry, unfortunately, it's made people very bitter. because they think that's not fair of God. Okay, let's take a 10-minute break. Come back around 20 after. Around 20, 25 after. Okay? Excuse me? Well, I think I hear the cops back here rattling. Would you shut that off again for me? And we need to close the door so that we don't lose this nice air out here. Well, what I want to do now is go quickly through the negative side of things and take maybe 15 to 20 minutes to give you reasons why I believe that the traditional greater good theodicy simply fails us on a number of grounds. So, and that's what I'm going to do in the next few minutes. If there's at some point you think, you know, you're not being fair, then please raise that. But if we make our way through, then I want to go to a creation order theodicy and see how I would build that and what it might look like. The greater good theodicy lacks support. It requires either an unambiguous propositional statement in the Bible affirming the affirmation of the greater good theodicy or the preponderance of the evidence. But I would argue that there is no unambiguous evidence that is propositionally. We've already looked at the Romans 8:28 text. That would only be for Christians. Job 1:21, that's only a testimony of Job. It is not, and nothing in that text says this is normative for all believers. The Genesis 50:20, the Joseph, that again, that is only a testimony. And in all those, there is no statement saying that a greater good prevailed. It's a testimony of those individuals. 2 Corinthians 1, 3 through 6 only tells us why God allows, what God does in suffering, not why he allowed it. Always be careful not to argue backwards. It's fallacious. It's a we call a logical fallacy. Just because God may bring some good from something does not tell us that that's why he allowed it in the first place. See, that would be arguing backwards. It's always fallacious to argue what God does with suffering to why God allowed the suffering. The evidence is against the claim. I say to someone, well, show me the good, which is often what has happened. Richard Swinburne's book, Providence and Evil, a good book, but it is set about to explain how we might see the good. And there are some very interesting things that are done in order to establish, the good obtained. But I'll not get into all of those. You know, someone says, the good of being used. So what that would be is, I go out here and I drive my automobile into an intersection, but it has no traffic lights, and I'm killed because somebody else slams into me and I'm killed. Well, the city of Chopron decides, in light of my death, we ought to put a traffic light up here so that nobody else will die. So someone would say, see, there's the greater good. You died, but the good is that now other people won't have to die because we're going to put the stoplight up. Well, of course, does that mean that nobody else is ever going to die in that intersection? And quite frankly, I'm not so sure that I like the notion of being used in that sort of a way. Now, understand what they're saying is that God planned it that way.
But the thing is that when they apply that to their knowledge of the politicians and they always think they are acting too late for that. They never say this was planned.
That's right. That's right. One cannot be consistent because they're going to complain that the council was too late. They should have done this earlier and saved my life. And quite frankly, I agree with those who complain against the council. A very good. We will not get into this, not that I can't. There are different categories. War seems to be a necessity because of evil, but it's not to bring about a greater good. But it is to bring about stability within the larger world society. So we do have issues where police, military, and things of that nature, but we would put them into different categories. Not that it's not an issue to be discussed, but probably I don't have the breadth of time to do it. Okay. And I don't want to interfere with what you've got to put together, okay? I just let you do your thing. Bear your own accountability, my brother. All right. Some would say that they explained the good. I didn't see it. They said, that's right, because God calculates good differently than we do. But the moment you start arguing that way, how then do you know when you have done good for God? If God looks at good differently than I do, I find no evidence in the Bible that God calculates good differently than I do. I actually get my idea of good from God. The only notion I have of what is good comes from God. If we say that now God calculates it differently than I do, then it seems to turn it all on the head. And I don't know what is good and what is not. It attempts to demonstrate the good. I've indicated the good of being used, the good to develop character, or the perfection of the soul. All of those, I think, raise some serious questions. But let's go to the weakness of the greater good theodicy.
They are partial answers, though. They're not the heart of the answer, but the development of character and perfection of soul are in there.
Precisely. We are not suggesting that that never happens. Thank you. We're saying that, you know, the good of being used, or the development of character, the perfection of the soul, we are surely saying that is part of it. Does God use suffering, that the trial of our faith is much, much precious than gold that perishes, though it be tried with fire, might be found to the praise, the honor, at the appearing of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ? Absolutely. We are not suggesting that suffering cannot be used in these ways, but only that that's not why God has permitted it in the first place. Thank you. Weaknesses in the greater good theodicy suggest evil is necessary to the plan of God. And that's a simple argument. If you tell me that a particular good will simply designate it as A, so here's a good, this is an A, that's the good, and the good comes from X, which is the evil, all right? The only way that this can come, the good can come, is if there's an evil from which God can work to bring about A. Do you understand what I'm saying there? If the good is necessary to the plan of God, then that also makes what necessary? It also makes the evil necessary. If you tell me the good is not necessary to the plan of God, then I'm asking you, then why did God allow the evil? Now you have not answered the question. You've still got the problem. So the argument that this evil leads to this good, if we say the good is necessary, then that also makes the evil necessary. If it makes the evil necessary, then it makes God the author of the evil.
To sort of suggest
it
a little quiet.
No, that's all right. I mean, I could go out there and cast the wrath of Greg upon them, but I'm not. I'm going to refrain. I don't feel pugnacious today. That means want to get into a fight. And they seem like more of them out there than us here. And I can't be sure that, as it was in the case of Elisha's servant, that his eyes were open and he saw that there were more for them than against them. So I think I'll just stay put. It commits us to an end, justifies the means position. It determines the correctness of the cause by the goodness of the outcome. That would throw ethics into a tailspin. It undercuts social justice. If the evil that exists is allowed by God, now you'd only know if God did allow it, right? So if there's an evil in the world, given the greater good theodicy, you can only conclude that God allowed it to bring about a what? Remember, the greater good theodicy, God only allows that evil from which he can bring about a greater good or prevent a worse evil. We already say the latter part is nonsensical. So if I see an evil and I apply the greater good theodicy to it, I would have to assume what? That God allowed the evil for what? Yeah, God allowed the evil for the good. Now, if that's true, why would I stop the evil? Right?
Yeah, you get into a kind of Hindu situation.
You know, yeah. As a matter of fact, in my book, I kindly even suggest that this looks like some modified Christian way of karma.
Yeah.
It does.
Yeah. But this is the same kind of argument that Paul says when I'm talking about sin. Let's sin.
Yeah.
The grace of abundance.
That's right. That's precisely right. The Romans 6 text. The Romans 6 text. It would lead to that notion, wouldn't it? Well, then let's really crank up some evil out here, because it will bring about a better world. In fact, there are even Christians, I won't mention names, who argue that way. I would say at least they're being consistent with the position. But doesn't the Bible require us as Christians to be against social injustice? Aren't we to stand up for the unborn, for the aged, for those who'd be euthanized? Shouldn't we stand against slavery and all kinds of social injustice? But if the greater good theodicy is right, let it go. Because from it will come a greater good. So it seems to me to paralyze, if we're consistent, it would paralyze social action. I've said, I'm really glad that the people who are my opponent in the issues of abortion and things of this, euthanasia, have not turned the greater good theodicy on us, because in effect it would actually argue right against everything that I think as Christians we ought to be doing. It raises the question about prayer, does it not? If God allows me to suffer from cancer, then there must be some good he wants to bring from it. Therefore, I shouldn't pray to be healed from it. Right? By the way, anybody know James Boyce? All right. James Boyce, you know, died of a tumor on the brain. I want to say this for James Boyce. He actually told his congregation, really, there's no sense to pray for me. If you want to, that's fine. But this is the will of God. That's at least being consistent with the position. But do most of us hold that position when we come to our prayer meetings? No. Mary says, you know, I've just been diagnosed with cancer, and we say, let's pray for Mary. Do we pray that she would be healed? Surely we do. Which seems to me to be legitimate prayer. Well, why do we do that if that evil has been allowed by God to bring about some greater good. Someone says, well, the greater good is it gets the church to pray. But what if the church doesn't pray? What do you do with Acts chapter 12, where you remember where Peter is in prison? But who had been in prison just a little before that? James. And he lost his head. The church wasn't praying. Someone said, I asked someone, well, what about slavery? Nobody, the church didn't rise up against slavery until the 19th century. What about all these people who suffered immeasurably through through slavery? What happens when the church doesn't act? You know what the response was? They went to heaven. Now that's a strange theology. That you get to heaven by being a slave and suffering. That doesn't seem to me what my Bible says. And quite frankly, I just prefer not to have to go to heaven that way. I just would be very happy by natural means. Fail to designate who receives the good. If the one suffering dies and goes to hell, then I ask who receives the good from his suffering. It's always a question of who receives the good. Is it me or someone else? Seems to me, according to God's economy, the good should always obtain to me. If I'm the one suffering, the good ought to obtain for me. That seems to be God's economy. Last objective criteria for measuring good. This is, I think, one of the strongest arguments against the greater good theodicy. Can you tell me of some scale that you can use that tells me that so much good justifies so much evil? Do you have a scale?
I don't know the greater good theodicy, but why would we need to be able to know? God might have a scale that we don't know.
Well, that is always a possibility, right? But in order to affirm that possibility, we would need some indication in Scripture that that is, in fact, the case. And I have no evidence in Scripture that that is the case, that God has a scale differently. Because, and furthermore, when I act in society, do I act on God's scale or my scale? I always act on God's scale, do I not? God tells me what is wrong. So I hear that, but I'm skeptical of it. Okay, simply because I see no evidence in Scripture that argument should prevail. There, yes, please.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. I'm done.
I was thinking about who receives the good.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, this whole family
dies. Yeah. But
he keeps the wife.
he keeps the wife. The idea is in Job's whole all of his children die. And somebody says, well, but he gets seven others back. But I have never talked to a parent who's lost a child who thinks that by having another child does away with the pain of losing the first child. Doesn't do it. Well, let me run this little scenario by you. It's going to be one of these arguments from absurdity. So I understand it, but I think it's valid. That means sound. Okay? Let's take an example. We're going to have a person. We'll call her Sue. I'm sorry. I just use American names. All right? Now, Sue is going to be, she is struck by her father. Okay? In a fit of rage, her dad strikes her in the face. And because of the ring, she has a scar on her face, all right? So she was a beautiful girl before this, but now she has a scar. So we'll call her Sue, and Sue has a scar and pain because of it, right? So that's suffering. So what are we going to call? So then I say, all right, I'm going to assign a numerical value. arbitrarily, but I'll be consistent all the way through. So it doesn't matter what value I give this. It will be arbitrarily. I'm going to suggest that because it is an evil, it's suffering, I'm going to say that on the scale, this is a minus two. All right? It's a negative. Why? Well, because it's suffering. All right? Now, there is going to be a good that God brings from that. Okay? Now, what value would we have to assign for good in order for there to be a net gain? What would we have to, what value do we have to assign for the good? Okay, so, right, so let's just do it this way if we can. All right, we'll just do a plus three. Now, is this a real good? We don't know what it is. I don't care what it is, but we can define it. It's a real good, right? You could really see it, just like you could really see this. So we have a net gain over here of one, right? So in this case, would this good be greater than this evil?
Yes.
Yes, okay. Now, let me take you to another situation. This is Sue again. Now, in this case, Sue is beaten. She's 5 years old. She's beaten, she's raped, she's dismembered, and she dies in the cold. Oh, gruesome. By the way, actually happened. Now, this seems to be a much worse thing of suffering than this one, right? So let's just call this a minus five. Because it's really worse, right? Now that means that over here in this column, we'll have to have at least what? Well, that's right. Because we're going to keep the net gain the same, all right? Now don't think of this as a mathematical equation, because it's not that. We're just using numerical values. So here we have a plus six. And did the greater good obtain? Yes, and we don't know what the plus six is. I'm not even trying to identify that. That's not important, okay? But we're just going to affirm the good really did happen. And it was enough, so it's greater than the evil, okay? Now, if this is an objective good, and this is an objective good, which is the greater good? The plus three or the plus six? Yeah, the plus six. So, which would make a better world? A world that has just a plus three good in it, or a plus six in it? Well, the plus six. Therefore, we conclude that it's really better that Sue be beaten, raped, dismembered, and left to die in the cold, because the result is it gives a better... Now, I have not had anybody in any presentation among colleagues, peers, whatever, that can find anything wrong with this argument. All I'm arguing here is the absurdity of the argument. I don't think any of us would agree to this. Of course not. It's absurd in the true sense. And then I would argue it relativizes the concept of good. It really does. Now, I say good is something in relationship to another act. When I talk about good in relationship to God, is good in relationship to God relative or absolute? What do you think?
Can you repeat your question?
Yes. When we talk about good as it relates to God, mm-hmm. is it relative or is it absolute? It tends to be absolute. But notice that when we use good with the greater good theodicy, it's very relative. I give you an example. It is good that John got such a good buy on his car. But suppose the reason that Jack had to sell the car to John so immediately was to pay for the medical help for his wife. So what is good for one person is actually bad for another person. I can also give you other scenarios where good and evil become very confused under this kind of a scenario.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
This is the error of consequentialism, and it's something we've been talking about in the bioethics track. Any consequentialist basis is wrong.
Yes.
And we're pushing to do all the work, time with the world, because it has no other alternative. And it's similar to utilitarianism. I'm just looking at John 11:50. Just wondered if you'd.
Okay, just hold that. Let me repeat this part. This deals with the issue of consequentialism, right, which creates a question for us in bioethics. And now the question that you have is over a text in John. All right.
Then one of them named Caiaphas, his high priest, said, "Yes, but you know nothing at all. You do not realize that it would benefit if you, one man, died for people, the whole nation perished," which is utilitarianism.
Yes.
I would think that was an evil plot of man, which shouldn't happen, and utilitarianism there is wrong. But it's linked to the prophecy that Jesus would die for the nation that year.
Yeah. Yeah, the question is on the issue of, you say, John 11? John 11:50? Yeah. About was it Caiaphas who says that it is better that one man should die for the whole nation? So does that seem to be, in your thinking, you see?
Is it good or is it, or was he right or wrong to say that? Was he evil?
The question that we would raise for this is whether or not this fits into the same category of which we are speaking. And I would argue that it does not. For example, these are areas, is this not, if this was a real situation, is this a matter of judgment or is it a matter of moral choice? If one person in this, you know, if one person could die in this room and save everybody else, what would be wrong? Just follow closely with how this can be understood in two different ways. Right. First of all, let me say the two different ways in which this can be understood. One way would be is that you volunteer to die. Okay? In that sense, would we say that that's a good act? Yes, but now notice, this has nothing to do with the greater good theodicy. This is simply saying that as a human being, you choose, as Jesus chooses to go to the cross. When you have personal choice involved, it's a totally different issue.
Okay, so the answer is, his prophecy was right, it was that Jesus would die, and that was good. And
yes.
It was good that Jesus died, but it was wrong that they intended it.
Yes, absolutely, but it's good in the sense that Jesus actually voluntarily goes to the cross.
So it's a morally neutral statement, but an evil plot is then with a good plan of God.
Yes, absolutely, yes, good.
I would recommend that when John interprets it as a prophecy, because he was a great priest, it doesn't imply that the argument itself is prophetical in the sense that it is really better that one man dies for many. What he says, he was a wicked man, and that was actually the wicked logic. It's better that one man. Not only the act itself was wicked, but the logic was wicked. Better that we kill him instead of that the Romans come and take away. And John just says, "Well, it's very similar to what was with the Joseph." And we said that you cannot take the logic and explain. Like when Joseph said that God meant it for good. Similarly here, when John says that he is high priest, actually did prophesy, he doesn't mean that his logic was godly, like that it's really better that Jesus died instead of us.
There's an irony in his statement, is that right?
Yes.
John sees it as ironic that Caiaphas intended to kill, but he unwittingly
Right. I think we need to, it's very careful in keeping categories clear in the discussion. And because we are going to, you have to talk about Jesus, right? Does Jesus suffer? And does a greater good come from his suffering? Sure. But in that case, it is a personal choice. That makes the difference. As it would be for if you were let's say that you were, you know, I talked about firemen or just an average citizen. If you choose to enter the fire and save a child, that's different than my throwing you into the fire, say. But those, as you can see, what so desperately needs to be done in discussions like this is take the sort of time that we are doing here and get definitions and categories clear. Because if you don't, the whole thing gets muddled down the end. And we end up discussing something and debating something that does not lie at the core of the initial issue.
And even, can we really say that it's greater good? I mean, can we really call it that was the greater good that Jesus died?
Well, right. The question is, could we say it's a greater good? I would not debate that issue with somebody. I think that one might argue that once again,
I mean, it's
yeah.
Grace,
let me say it's good for me, right? It's good for me that Jesus died. But is it a greater good? I can't calculate that, folks. I don't know what was it like on the cross. I don't know. But I am assuming from the cry from the cross for 3 hours, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? I don't know that if I could even plunge the depths of understanding what Jesus encountered on the cross. Because of that, it makes it very difficult for me to say that my salvation was greater. That seems to me to be a very selfish turn on the thing.
But can we at all talk greater, it's good is good.
Yeah.
Evil is evil.
Yes, we can, right, that good is good, evil is evil. Why we need to talk about the greater? Of course, the greater good theodicy needs that. But I can affirm, for me, was it good that Jesus died? Yes. But can I say that my salvation was a greater good than the price Jesus paid? And I don't think I'm in a position to say that. And I don't think those are the grounds on which it was calculated by the Savior to go to the cross. All of the Bible says is that through this, in Hebrews, it says that by this he leads many sons into glory. That's good. But as you have indicated, are we able to juxtapose two things and say this is a greater good than the evil and the suffering here? Well, let's look then at the let's look at the creation order theodicy. A creation narrative, for me, provides the proper foundation for a theodicy. Now, I will introduce this. This is not essential to this position. How many have heard of middle knowledge? Okay. And this is becoming quite popular. It's been around for, 600 years. But it's become quite popular in evangelical circles. Amongst people, it is, let me say clearly, it is not theological sensitive. I am libertarian freedom person. Alvin Plantinga is reformed person. Alvin Plantinga holds to middle knowledge. So it doesn't matter, you know, you say, well, you know, you believe in, libertarian traditionalism. By the way, Richard Swinburne tells us that for the first 400 years of the church, libertarian was the view, not the reformed view, that the libertarian view, but I'm not here to discuss that.
So it's not open theology.
No, right. Good. It's not open theism, though people in open theism have appealed to middle knowledge, but they've changed middle knowledge. So just to quickly take... what it says is that God's middle knowledge is God has natural knowledge, free knowledge. By the way, this is what everybody affirms, natural knowledge and free knowledge. But he also has middle knowledge. All I will say for this, without getting into detail, is that God knows not only what did happen, but God knows under every condition what would have happened. That's all. Would have happened. For example, Jesus says, woe unto you, Chorazin, woe unto you, Capernaum, if Sodom and Gomorrah would have seen the miracles that you have seen, they would have repented in sackcloth and ashes. Okay? It's God knows. See, when we talk about counterfactuals, a counterfactual is only an if. If I would have done this, I didn't do it. So how do I know? But God does know counterfactuals. Yeah, okay, yes, we're back to Leibniz, aren't we? Yes. I'm just giving this as I understand it. What my understanding is that before there was any act of creation, God knew all possible worlds. And God sovereignly chooses to actualize the best of all those possible worlds. And this world that we are living in is the best of all possible worlds. Not conceivable worlds, but possible worlds. It's not a really a far-fetched notion. I think it has scriptural support. Alvin Plantinga holds to this. I'm just showing you that people from different theological perspectives hold to middle knowledge. And he, along with myself, not that I am in the same category intellectually with Alvin Plantinga, but Plantinga and I would not talk in this kind of a conversation about God creating, but about God actualizing, which entails his creative powers. So as I would see it, when I talk about God creating the world, I'm only talking about the material aspect and moral and physical ordering of the universe. I'm not talking about the history of the universe. If when we say that God created this world, we included the history of this world, that would lead to what, do you think? If God created the history, each event, what would it lead to? Yeah, determinism. It would lead to determinism. Yes, it would lead to God being responsible for evil as well. But it would lead to determinism, wouldn't it? So I just, again, I'm trying to be careful with my language. I mean, I'm not swearing or anything. But I'm trying to be careful with my language. And to, yeah, that's right. We can get it expunged, can't we? Hope I don't sound too Platonic, but I think that in the mind of God, since God knows all things, God would have known all possible worlds before he actualized any of them. And this is the world that he actualized, because it's the best world. Now, by the best, it means the best under the circumstances. The best under the circumstances. And one of the circumstances is a being with the power to choose. And Augustine said, you couldn't have a best world if man didn't have the power to choose.
So you agree here with Augustine?
Yes, yes, I do. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Many of those of us who hold to middle knowledge, like Plantinga, myself, Bill Craig, and others, what I would see is that in world, let's just say in world A, and there's A prime, and we're just going to deal with two different worlds, okay? There are probably more than this, but just two worlds, okay? In world A, I'm going to use something that hopefully won't be controversial. On world A, I chose to go to Sopron, Hungary, June 17th, 2005. All right? In A prime, I chose not to go to Sopron, Hungary on April 17th, year 2005. All right. Now, given this, which world did God actualize? Well, that's right, he actualized A. Now, supposing that when I came to Sopron, I caught a horrible disease and both of my legs rotted down to the bone. Okay? And I say to God, why didn't you actualize this world where I didn't go to Sopron? But the fact is, in this world, did I really choose to go to Sopron in this world, and would I really have chosen not to go to Sopron in this world? So I can't blame God. Because in this world, I perfectly chose not to go to Sopron. Now, obviously, when God chooses which world he's going to actualize, is the only thing he takes into consideration is what Bruce is doing? No. He's managing what? Everything. Only a God of the magnitude of the Bible could possibly do that. So I can't. I would even say, though I don't know if I want to get into this, let me even tell you something very, very, very important. Let's say that in A, I rejected Jesus. In A prime, I accepted Jesus. I know there are some philosophical, theological issues here, okay? But just hang with me for a minute, because this is Plantinga's view, as well as my own. Let's say that in A, I reject Jesus, okay? And in A prime, I accept Jesus. Well, you may be questioning this, but given the scenarios that we're presently living, we are in A prime. Because I accepted Jesus. I have been baptized twice. If you need any other credentials to let you know that I'm in the kingdom, I will try to bring some personal testimonies or something, okay? Now, what if, under this scenario, God had actualized A? And I'd said, God, this is not fair. But do I really have any complaint against God? Did in this world I freely choose to reject Jesus? If you can accept that theology. Yes, I freely chose it. So whatever state of affairs I'm in, it's my choice, my free choice. But once God actualizes one of these worlds, this is the world that will play out. That's all. This is how Alvin Plantinga and many of the rest of us bring together God's sovereignty and God and power of choice, man's free will. God chooses which world is actualized based upon his own character. But within that world, it includes some of the choices of mankind that shape history. So that's why I say God in His sovereignty chose to create a world, whether it be moral agents like Himself. This is world, in the best of terms, God's providential governance. Now, I think, for me, Genesis 1:31 is the point to begin. Now, Genesis 1:31 says, after God had created everything, He looked at all that He had made and said what? It's very good. Now, I heard somewhere, someone said, but it wasn't the best. It didn't say it was the best. I understand that. But the word good in the Hebrew means good in every kind of sense, whether it be aesthetic goodness, moral goodness. It's a very broad term. Now, here's my argument. If you think it has no merit, then just be easy on me, that's all. Let's say, I will argue this, that when you have an evaluative judgment, right, the force of the evaluative judgment is predicated upon the nature of the person making the judgment. Let me give you an example of what I mean. Let's suppose that we have a homeless person. It's a very cold, wintry day. And I see him out on the street, and I invite him into my home. I'm not a good cook, all right? So I make a stew for him, something that's hot, but it's really pretty bad stuff, all right? Now, he sits down, and he begins to eat this soup, and he says, oh, this is so good. Now, what if I serve the same soup to a connoisseur of fine soups? And what will he say about my soup? It's horrible. Now, what makes the difference between the evaluative statements? The condition, the state, or the nature of the person making the evaluative judgment, right? Now, who makes the judgment about the world that had been created? God. Now, against what could it be measured? Yes, it has been measured against God. If God is the only standard for measuring this contingent reality, when God says it's very good, I argue that that is tantamount to saying it is the very best. That's my argument.
Yes. Everyone's debated, so I want to get on to the answer to suffering. You said this isn't contingent, but you're coming from a scientific or a philosophical background, as am I, but if you came from an artistic background, and sort of background
yes.
that the sculptures come from,
yes.
They would strongly object and say that there is only one possible best, and they would say that prevents God being creative, and God isn't just rational and a rationalist and philosophical sense of the word, but He's creative, and He can't be constrained in His creativity to only one possible outcome. He could have shaped the globe differently. He could have put another Australia on the bottom, or South America would have been a different shape. The fact that it's a wonderful, weird shape, and it has an intrinsic beauty, it reflects God's creativity. And I think the same is true in life, but I don't think we can possibly say that there is any one possible best. We can say that He has expressed to His utmost His creative ability and His righteous ability. But if you say there is any one possible best, well, you prevent Him being creative, and I think the artist would object to that.
Yeah. I think, yes, I understand the argument. That would be Plantinga's argument as well. How would we know when we had a best? Right. But I think that the argument fails on two counts. One, the argument, and this, they're connected, the argument that we have from aesthetics, which I teach on that issue, is based upon contingent beings as we view this sort of a thing in creativity. Okay?
No, it doesn't, because he can create a desert flower which is never seen by any contingent thing. He sees it for his own glory.
Yeah, right. But what I'm saying is, I am making these judgments about what criteria and what statements can be, evaluative statements can be made about any particular creative piece. That there's always the possibility of doing something different. Was there always the possibility of God doing something different? Yes. But what I would argue is that's not what I'm talking about. I would have no problem with different configurations, different flowers. That would be totally open to me. What I'm arguing here for being best is best in the terms of its moral and physical ordering. I'm not arguing for all the other different little pieces. Just for the moral, physical ordering of the universe. I would agree that there could have been a world that might have been a little bit different, you know, that had different shape to it.
You're assuming infinite complexity.
What's that?
I think you're assuming infinite complexity and infinite number of different moral decisions.
No, I'm not. I think it's finite.
Well,
yeah. Okay. Right. They're good. And that's good questions, and things that have to be raised. But just so that at this point in time, I only argue, and I do think that there are a finite number of possible worlds.
Wait. And I'd agree. Yeah. I think there's any more possible best than there's any infinite number of possible worlds.
Okay. All right. Fine. Good. But. It does seem to me that what God did was good. I would say it's very good, and I would even argue it's the best. And I do think I have to argue it's the best in terms of moral ordering and structuring. And the reason I would argue that is, if this is not the best world, which includes suffering, then that would mean there would be in a better world where there wouldn't be as much suffering, or at least intense suffering. There are two kinds of mind as part of reality, the necessary mind, the contingent mind. Before there was anything, there was only God. What I find so interesting is that what God does in creation is that he creates another mind. I almost think of that as kind of being risky. I mean, if it's going to be a real mind, before there was anything, there was only God. There was nobody to interfere. But now, God actually creates another mind. Now, why does God create another mind? When I say another mind, I mean another kind of mind. There are many of these. You know, you have one, I have one. Some function better than others. We won't put all of them to test today. So, if man has a real mind, then man has a power. He has to have the power to choose. That is part and parcel of mind in normal function. I'm talking about now in order of creation. I'm not talking about, you know, it just because a person, you can go in, you can do a frontal lobotomy on a person. I understand that, and they would still have a mind. But that's an impact on the mind from the outside. I'm just talking about what constitutes a mind ontologically. All right. Now, why does God give man a mind, which we say he certainly does, evidenced by naming the animals, right? He's able to categorize. Now, and these two minds, the moral ordering of the universe is such a way that now God is able to interact meaningfully with his created order. Not only that, but he has this high responsibility that is given to man, and that is that the highest thing that man can do, in my understanding, is to love God. According to Matthew, you know, the greatest commandment is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, and your neighbor as yourself. And I think an argument can be made that love entails power of choice. That you do not have love if you cannot choose. To choose is required in order to actually love. Now, I don't think that God gave man an unlimited range of possibilities to choose from. And I would just simply say it is something like this. that God has a range that he has given man, and within this range, man can make choices. Not outside this range. That would be forbidden. Forbidden. Within this, man can actually exercise choices that are placed before him and choose one over the other, but only within the range that God has given him. And this mind, not only can he use this mind to love God, but he can also use this mind to love his fellow, his neighbor, as the Bible says. Love his neighbor as himself. In order for the mind of man to truly function as a mind, God limited the manifestation of some of his non-moral divine attributes in his interaction with man. I would say that God has willingly, I would say sovereignly, chosen to limit the manifestation of some of his non-moral attributes as he interacts with man. It seems to me if he didn't do that, we'd all become crispy critters a long time ago. You know, I just... is it beyond the scope of theology or the Bible to affirm that God can limit the manifestation of his attributes? Yeah, okay. Do we have any example in the Bible, first of all, where God limited the manifestation of some of his attributes in order that he might interact with man?
When Moses, he was going to wipe out
the... All right. We have a case where God responds to the plea of Moses not to wipe out the people. All right?
He hides himself in a cloud when he appears.
All right. Because it would have been too...
No, I can't see.
That's right. So where is the ultimate of this, do we see?
Jesus.
Yeah, in the incarnation. We see this in the incarnation, don't we? And I would just argue that God has done this in order that he might interact meaningfully with mankind. I believe that very strongly, I believe in total depravity. I believe that man is a sinner in every respect. But I don't think that man is a zero. I don't think man is a worm. I think that is to depreciate the work of God. I am made in the image of God, even as a sinner. And theologically, yes, I am a worm, if you please. But ontologically, I am not a worm. I am the highest order of God's creative work. I don't think I want to depreciate that. In fact, as far as I know, we are the only created beings that God interacts with as he does. I mean, he talks to us. He sent his son to die for us. The author of the Epistle of the Hebrews is clear that he only did that for mankind. He didn't even do it for angels. I don't think we want to minimize that. I would argue that when God chose to create, he not only chose what he would populate that creation with, but he also determined what would be the rules. I just call it created order. What would be the order that would exist in this created order so that God could meaningfully interact with his creative work? So that God doesn't act capriciously. So on the one hand, we have the commandments of God that tells us what God requires of us. On the other hand, we have the promises of God that tell us what we can expect of God. I understand God was under no obligation to do any of that. But he has done that. I don't act in a chance world. I always know what to expect of God, don't you? I mean, do you ever think you have to wake up the next morning and think that God has changed the rules? That would really be not too much fun. All right? You know, when I was growing up, I had my brother who was 3 years my elder. And whenever we played a game, he invariably changed the rules when he started losing. He changed the rules on me. I would argue because God is a faithful creator, he does not do that. This is a part of created order. It's not the only thing, but it is, and this is what I mean by the best of all possible worlds. This is the best way that that you could structure a contingent reality so that you can have meaningful interaction between an infinite mind and a finite mind, where communication can actually go on and man, this finite being, can actually do things that please the infinite being. Or really please the infinite being. Oh, you stop to think about that. That's quite a thing indeed. And we do it when we choose to do it. And that's why it pleases God. Things that are forced to be done to please nobody. You know, the little girl who, I have a granddaughter, and I also have a grandson. I have a granddaughter, and she's fastidious about many things, but not the order in which she keeps her room. And she just kind of keeps a path from the door to the bed. Every now and then, Mommy has to come and say, clean up your room or else. And so she dutifully goes about and straightens up the room. That's not really pleasing to Mom. Only in the degree that she's obeyed Mom, but she usually does it with a little bit of disagreement. But what about when the little girl tumbles out of bed and just says, I know that my mommy wants my room to be well ordered. I am going to order it as it ought to be. And then she toddles out into the kitchen and says, Mommy, come in and look at my room. Now, which one pleases Mommy more? Well, it's this one in which one voluntarily acts without fear of force or some kind of serious negative repercussions, does what should be required of them. It comes back to this thing, why do you serve God? Do you serve God because you love him and therefore you choose? Or do you serve God because you're afraid if you get out of line, he's going to drop the hammer on you? And he might. But I'm not a prophet. Which one do you think pleases God more? It comes back to the Job issue. Or in that case, you serve God because he does good things for you. I think it's a phenomenal arrangement, but it requires some element of the power of moral choice. Which, of course, comes with its own problems. We know that there's a moral ordering to the universe. It's revealed in the Ten Commandments. Now, Adam was not perfect in the sense that God is perfect, right? But was Adam, do you think Adam was flawless?
I think Adam was perfect. I mean, he was just perfect creation. He was not perfect.
Okay.
Like God.
Okay. Yeah. So that's why I choose to use the word flawless.
Yeah.
But he would be perfect as much as a created being can be perfect. Right? He is as much as a created being could be perfect. If he were perfect like an uncreated being, then he would not be a created being. He would be an uncreated being. Now, what are some of the laws that work in this universe, or part of the ordering? I would say the law of the harvest, the law of repentance, There are privileges like prayer. So the law, for example, the law of repentance. Is it possible that when judgment is coming, is it possible that if judgment is coming, that if I repent of my sin, that the judgment could be stayed? Is it possible? Yeah. But has God changed his mind? No. That's the law of repentance, isn't it? If my people hear my voice, repent from my sin, their sin, then I will heal them. We see this happening in Jonah, in Nineveh. There's also this, if there's this matter of the privilege of prayer. Now, for Adam to overcome his creatureliness, he chose not to love God. Isn't this really what this is about? Isn't the fact that Adam is limited, that he doesn't like? Isn't this the very thing that Satan appeals to man? His limitedness. Because what does he offer him? To be what? To become like God. God is not limited. Right? I think the issue is limitedness. Are we limited? Of course we are. We're limited in many ways. Ontologically, epistemologically, that is knowledge-wise, we're limited. We're limited in power. We're limited in strength. And Adam didn't like being in that condition. So he chooses not to love God. And he demonstrates it by disobeying God in an attempt to be like God. Because he was over all creation felt the consequences of sin. From this flows, either directly or indirectly, all suffering and pain in this world. Now, that's my understanding. I hold that there would have been no suffering in the world, no pain, if there had not been a fall. Somebody asked me the other day, well, what if Adam climbed a tree and fell out of a tree? Would he break his leg? And I thought about it for a moment. I said, well, I don't know. Maybe it never would enter Adam's mind to climb too high in a tree. That wasn't a very good answer. Someone came up to me later and said, Lewis said, and I don't know how I'd missed this, or maybe read it and forgotten it, Lewis said that if man fell out of the tree, his bones would be so strong that they wouldn't break anyway. Well, that's probably a better answer. When Adam and Eve sin, do things seem to change on this earth, even within nature?
Yeah.
What does God make for them? A garment. Why? Well, I suggest, had they made garments? Yeah, well, that's right. And that's what these garments would do, right? But they did more than simply. I think there's a very utilitarian aspect to these coats, these aprons of leather. Because now you're going to live in a world where there are thorns and thistles. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't like to crawl around naked, in a raspberry patch, okay? I think these coats actually helped to buffer man against some of the hostility that was already in his world as a result of sin. Do I think that's the only thing it was about? No. But don't you think that often God does things that both that have two values to them? Consider the pillar of fire by night and the cloud by day. Isn't it interesting that God chooses that to demonstrate his presence? Why would that be so interesting? What pragmatic value does that have? Can you think of any pragmatic value of the pillar and the of fire and the cloud? Well,
but if he's leading, you know,
yeah, yeah, but why didn't he just put a stick out there? Follow the stick. You know, that's the green stick. When the green stick appears, you go. When the red stick appears, you stop.
Okay, and the cloud shields you from the sun in the day, and the fire lights up your night.
Absolutely, and particularly when you're living in the desert. Right? Gets really hot at night, tends to get cold in the evening. I think there's some very, if you call it, pragmatic value to the what God chooses to use. He keeps the shade by the day, and he is the fire by night. Yeah. Well, there are a lot of things I haven't thought of before in my life either, so maybe you could share some of the things with you that you have that I haven't yet. Well, you already gave me that good definition to misname something. Now, what I would then argue is that God is a faithful creator and he lives against the rules and the self-imposed limitations as he acts providentially and moves all things that are predetermined in. So when Bruce chooses a bad thing within this range, Bruce is going to find the bad consequences from it. And when a man over here chooses to do a bad thing to Bruce, can God providentially intervene? He can. But has he given us any promise that he will in every case? No. So every morning when I wake up, one of the things I do is I pray for safety. I do. I pray for safety. And be free from accident and harm. I pray that for my family as well. But then God might respond to my prayer, I realize. So if man has this kind of freedom of which I speak, within the range of possibilities with which I think exist, then, when man sins, then there is some evil or suffering that results. God is not obligated to bring any good from that because he hasn't promised that he would. This is what I would call gratuitous evil. Does God allow it? Yes, because it's an outworking of what? Just the way the world has been constructed. If I walk up here, you know, the proverb says that, you know, But the ringing of the nose brings forth blood. Let's see if that works. Now, you know, so if I go and I ring somebody's nose and the blood comes out, well, and you get a lot of pain, that's just the way the world is. I walk out here and I walk out on the street and somebody says there's an American, I bet he's got a lot of money. But it doesn't say that they don't know that I'm a professor at a seminary. So I don't have a lot of money, all right? And so they strike me, and they rob me, they take my wallet. Somebody just made a bad choice. I suffer from it. Now, in my suffering, is God able to minister to me in his grace? Yes, he is. But he has not said, I'm going to bring some greater good out of this evil that's come into your life. I see now, am not compelled by a theodicy to explain what the good is out of the evil that we see. I no longer have that obligation. Whereas those who hold the greater good theodicy do have that obligation. Ronald Nash, and any of you know Ronald Nash? Heard of Ronald Nash? Ronald Nash is the Reformed tradition, and he says, if there is gratuitous evil, then the scale tips in the favor of the theist. And I think, he says, there is good reason to believe that there is gratuitous evil in this world. Gratuitous. Gratuitous. No particular point. We are watching a movie and somebody swears and somebody says, that's gratuitous. That means the storyline could have progressed very nicely without the swearing. Yeah. Right? So that's the word gratuitous. That things happen. It's a fallen world. So when I go to the hospital, which I have on many occasions, and I minister to a family, if they ask me this question, why? I say, listen, we live in a fallen world. These things happen. Has God given you a promise that it would never happen to you? No. Then, if you live in a fallen world, we expect those things to happen. But in that, can I know the grace and comfort of God? Yes. And can that grace and comfort become a testimony to others? Yes. I gave this illustration the other day, but I was preaching and at my church at some place, and one of the doctors came up to me and he said, "Oh, I'd like to introduce you to Dr. So-and-so. Dr. So-and-so is the head of the oncology department, just came down from Mayo Clinic." And I said, "Mayo Clinic, when were you there?" And he said, 84, 85. I said, "You know, is it possible that you met Francis Schaeffer?" Because I knew that Schaeffer was there in his last weeks dying in Mayo Clinic at that time. He looked at me and he said, "That's interesting." He said, "The first day that I was at Mayo Clinic, the first room on my rounds was the room of Francis Schaeffer." He said, "I was not a Christian at that time. But when I walked into that room and met Francis and Edith Schaeffer," he said, "I knew that there was something different, that there was something operating in their lives that was not operating in my life." Now, he didn't say that's what led him to Christ or anything like that, but it was an evidence of the grace and the mercy and the comfort of God. While there may have been, you know, we can't say, "Oh, this is why God permitted it," but in that it comes, God is able to work in that and give comfort and grace, and that can become evident. I've seen this happen so many times in the ministry, where we have seen people who, and I, you know, for years, this is how I've ministered to people in difficult times. I have not tried to get them to focus on the good. Is it possible that God might so work to bring about something good in any kind of situation? Sure. Sure it is. But that's not where my comfort is. That's not where my focus is. My focus is on God, who is the Father of all comfort, the God of all mercy, or the God of all comfort, the Father of all mercy. Always knowing that His grace is always what? It's always sufficient. It's interesting that when people begin to focus on His mercy, on His comfort, and stop looking for the good, you'll have fewer people who become disillusioned with God. When you tell people that it's happened because of the good, what is the normal propensity of us to look for what? To look for the good. And I don't... Is it possible there's some good that God has accomplished in His scheme that I don't see? Yeah, it is. But I don't see it, so I don't really know what's going on. So it's a matter of focusing on what God is doing. Since... let me go to arguing. I don't mean in a bad way. God is a faithful creator. He lives by the rules. Can I know that grace is always sufficient? Yes, I can always know that. That's my comfort. Folks, that's really my comfort. I don't know what tomorrow may bring. But I do know that in any situation, He has promised to never leave me nor to forsake me. That His grace will be sufficient. That He's the God of all comfort, the Father of all mercies. That's my comfort. And that's the same kind of comfort I try to give others. I think that we Christians may suffer for two different reasons. One, living in a fallen world. We do live in a fragile world. At any time, our life on this earth can end without notice, could it not? The Tower of Siloam in Luke chapter 13. And Jesus doesn't make any point about some greater good. He just simply says, this is a warning. Except you repent, you will likewise perish. Not that the tower would fall on them, but he goes on to make it very clear, he's talking about eternally perishing. We must always be ready. Right after 9/11, I was doing a TV interview, and someone asked me, what do we learn from this? I said, this is what we learn from this, folks. Life is fragile. Any one of us can leave our home and the tower fall on us. Are you ready to meet eternity? I think this is one way in which apologetically we use this whole thing about the things that happen. See, I shift the discussion. I was in a Eastern European country and had been asked to do a TV interview. And I went to the TV station, and it was going to be done out in this nice little area outside. And this young lady, a very attractive young lady, who was going to be the interviewer, is walking with me, and she's never met me before. Her first question, why do we suffer? And she was speaking of the Russian people. Why do we suffer so? And that gave a great opportunity to talk about what is the cry of the human heart. Why do you think there is something, there should be something better than what is? And why do you think it should actually actualize? Where'd you get that notion? Jesus said we must be ready, for we too will perish. None of us knows when the tower will fall on us. So the Bible says in Hebrews 3 and 4 that what we should harden not our hearts as in the day of the provocation. Today, if you can hear his voice, what? You don't harden your heart. Why? How do you harden your heart? By rejecting that conviction. What a horrible state of affairs to come to the point where you no longer hear the voice of God. You know, I've often thought about that. Not being a Christian until I was 20. And I'd had the light. My dad became a Christian when I was, I think, in the seventh grade. We lived in a rural community where there was no gospel witness and there were no other Christians. And my dad became a believer by reading his Bible. The Spirit of God touched my dad when I asked him to go to church on an Easter morning. My dad had never gone to church. He was having trouble with drinking. We lived on a farm. We didn't have a lot. And for some reason, I think it's not coincidental, my dad agreed to go. But the gospel was not preached. But the resurrection story was read. The Spirit of God used the reading of the Word to put a hook in my father's soul, as it was. And all that summer, we would finish haying in the hay field and come home, and Dad would go in, sit down in his big chair, and read his Bible, which was quite a turn from what he had done in the past. So my dad witnessed to my brother and myself, and I did not become a Christian until I was 20 years of age. But I think to myself, you know, what if I were to continue to have said no? What a terrible state of affairs to come to the place where I couldn't hear the Spirit any longer. So the need to be prepared, which is important. And that's the point that Jesus makes. That's the point I make with people who are going through suffering. Do you see how quickly this came upon the others? You think it should not come quickly upon you? Are you ready? If you think there's nothing on the other side, then why are you so worried about it? But then I think that man also, Christians suffer, because they live righteously in a fallen world. That's why I think we apply the Romans 8:28. I don't tell anybody look for the good. I'm just saying because I walk by faith and not by sight. The Bible says God's at work in your life. But we have to be clear about when a person is really suffering for righteousness. Jesus says what? When people persecute you and say all manner of evil, for what? My name's sake. James says, the trial of your faith. Peter says the same thing. 1 Peter 3:14 says, but even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you're blessed. In other words, there is this parsing out. Oh, suffering for righteousness' sake. Just because I'm a Christian doesn't mean I suffer for righteousness' sake. I hope I'm not a prophet. But if I'm in a plane crash and I die today or tomorrow, would you say I suffered for righteousness' sake? No. There was a missionary couple I talked about, good friends of ours, members of my church, who were shot down by the Peruvian government. You may have heard of that several years ago. They were going to another city in South America to register their daughter they had just adopted and to get a visa for her and a passport. And they were shot down by the Peruvian government. Now, I submit this with all compassion, and I deeply love those two people. But when Ronnie was killed, that was the wife, and their new baby, just the dad had just, he was right in the front of a small plane. Ronnie was in the back, and the Peruvian government started shooting, and he took the little girl, and he just handed her back to her mom. And just at that time, a Peruvian bullet pierced the back fuselage of the plane, went through Ronnie's back, killed her instantly, went through the baby and killed the baby instantly. Jim and his son survived. They crashed the plane, the pilot did, into the water. And the pilot, Jim, and the son survived. I say this carefully, but in my thinking, they did not suffer for righteousness' sake. They suffered because they lived in a fallen world. They weren't shot down because they were Christians. It was an honest mistake. They were thought to be drug runners. And you're working, there was a communication problem and all of that. And the investigation was done by both governments and it came out there was no wrongdoing. It was an unfortunate thing, yes, definitely. See, I would feel no obligation to try to point to some good that comes from that. None. So then, did God sustain Ronnie, Jim? Ronnie needed no grace. She died instantly. Same. So, did God give grace and mercy to Jim and the little boy? Yes, he did. And partly that was ministered through the family of God. And partly, I think it was directly by the Spirit of God. That's what I would want to focus on. There are certain points and certain circumstances God can and has, when it's consistent with His character and purpose, to intervene in the affairs of men because of His goodness, in answer to the prayer of His people, or just because of His grace. Do you know the last time God intervened in your life? I suspect you probably don't. Why? Well, He may have intervened when you weren't even aware of it, right? If God is providentially engaged, as I think He is, then He is at work in this area. But He's not guaranteed to do that. Surely.
Yeah, can I ask this last sentence? Because of His grace, people would ask, when this time He shows His grace, yeah,
yeah. I think, that's a good question. Why does God not manifest His grace in that way? He always manifests His grace. Does He not? The fact that any one of us continue to live is a manifestation of His grace, in His common grace. That's why I say His character and His purpose. There may be that God has a real reason for intervening. Purpose is known to Him. Now, the question is going to be the fairness of God in this, isn't it? Okay. And here's my response to that. If God intervenes in your life and shows His grace, And whereas he has not obligated himself to do it for me, there is no unfairness in God doing that if, in intervening for you, he does no harm to me. And as long as that's happened, then God is free to do that. And I would say, God's wisdom, and I'm not afraid to make that case with people. I would just say, you'd have to give me grounds that God is obligated to do it in every case. And then I would have to say, so you think God hasn't exercised grace in your life?
Yeah, but I was just talking about the scientific track, which I think is relevant.
Yes.
Charlie Faxton, I don't know if you know him, used to go in the wheelchair with one leg. He was lecturing at Charles University to atheist students, and they said, now that you've only got one leg, Dr. Faxton, don't you hate God? And he said, no, you've only got two legs. Do you love God?
Yeah, that's a great, see, that's a great, it's a great comeback, right. Yeah. See, I think there's an assumption here that grace is only manifest when we see it in bigness, writ large. I would argue grace is present all the time. See?
And one person told me that we shouldn't be surprised something bad happened in our life. We should be surprised something good happened in our life.
Yeah, I think that's right. The statement is that we should not be surprised when something bad happens, but when something good, given the terror and the out of jointness of this world. That's precisely right.
Yes, precisely. We can explain the consequences of the fall and the common grace, actually, that it's a wonder that we can be good fathers and parents even if we're not Christians. And
Exactly. So I think this... Yes. Often we need to challenge the assumptions underlying the comments of people. And just say, wait a minute, I'm not sure I accept that assumption. Now, I say then that God is morally justified in allowing gratuitous evil in this world. He honors his word, and all he has promised was that death would come if man disobeyed. And then, of course, we have the opportunity to tell the real story, don't we, of the cross, and that this is not all there is. There is that which comes. Therefore, a Christian, if the Christian does not claim the greater good as justification for God allowing the evil, the atheist argument against God is greatly weakened, as there is no obligation for the Christian to demonstrate that God has obtained the good. Furthermore, the Christian's focus in suffering is redirected from looking to the good to looking to the Father of mercies, the God of all comfort. Pray, be faithful to God, entrust the all-wise God to do what is right in each situation. I would then say that our hope as Christians is not in this world. It is in the world to come. I think we betray our commitment to this world by some of the approaches and responses that we have to the events of this world.
Can I just ask?
Yes.
Why you categorize it in the second curse of suffering, living in the fall, suffering from righteousness?
Which one was that?
Romans 8, why you think it's exclusively suffering from
righteousness?
Yes. Because famine and trouble.
Ah. Yeah, done. Go to the go to the text before that. What does he say? For thy sake, he quotes from Isaiah.
And then that's what comes after. Famine comes before.
Okay, right. All right, but famine comes later too, okay? What shall separate us from the love of God? But all right, you just read the text. I mean, I really would like that. Okay, so he's saying, for your sake, we are facing these things, famine, the sword. And is that not precisely what happened to the early Christians? Was it not precisely because of their faithfulness to God that these things followed. And he says, it's for your sake we are killed all the day long. And then he also talks in that same text about, you know, well, who is it that condemns? It's God that justifies. It seems that Paul's emphasis here, if you start with the first verse of Romans 8, work your way through, Paul talks about walking in the Spirit, doesn't he? And not walking in the flesh. And the next subject he takes up is the issue of suffering. Yeah, that's right. When you and I walk in the Spirit and not in the flesh, do we run afoul of the world? Does the world begin to hate us? And as a result of that, may things turn that we suffer from this. And then he says, yes, and for your sake, we are killed all the day long.
But he still starts with generally the creation being subjected to frustration and decay of the whole of creation.
Yes.
And he's talking about assurance that we're going to get to heaven.
Yes, yes.
Which is more general. And I think this covers famine of the children in Africa as well as the famine of the persecuted saints.
Well, that's an exegetical issue. I think...
Because in the situation of Christian children suffering in Africa due to the sin of the world, that we've not got food to them,
yeah.
God is working for good in that situation. I think it's him promising it to you as well.
Well, let me also say... I think that's... I think we have to be careful here about, you know, trying to understand the Scriptures in light of what's going on in the world. I would prefer to try to understand what's going on in the world in light of the Scriptures. And I'm not suggesting you're necessarily doing that. I'm just trying to make some divisions here for our discussion purposes. You also know that text, the Romans 8:28 text, I don't know if you've done any textual work in this area, that text is translated various ways. Matter of fact, there are older texts that actually put the all things connected to the verse before in the Spirit praying for us, which would then really even question as to whether or not the all things is even talking about suffering, but rather talking about as the Spirit prays in our behalf. Now, I think the strength of the text would lead to the idea, to the conclusion that Romans 8:28 is for suffering for righteousness' sake, and it seems to be consistent with all the other texts we have, because we do know that Christians suffer, they will be blessed. What about some of these other things? And my question would be, children dying in Africa, for example, do you think that's working out for some good?
No, I'm not saying that.
Okay.
I'm saying that Christian children are starving.
Yes.
And
okay, it's Christian children in Africa.
He's loved them and had his love.
But what if they...
In every way he interacts with their life.
Okay.
He loves them, and therefore every interaction must be good.
Oh, okay. I see the inference you're drawing there. I'm not willing to draw that inference. I would infer that it is good that God intervenes and graces them in their state of affairs. I would not argue that...
Yeah, sorry.
Oh yeah, I don't deny. So, just a kind of a miscommunication here. Right, no, I would not agree, I would not deny that. But of course, then that takes us outside of the problem of evil per se. So, but
yeah.
No, we'd be in agreement. Yeah. Okay. Good.
I think there is possibility to say that God is using suffering to bring about good for Christians, even if it's not only the suffering which is caused when Christians walk.
Okay.
Spirit, but also this casual suffering. And it does not mean that God needs that suffering to achieve the same thing. Like, he can use the suffering to make us more perseverant and more patient and so on, so to be the fruit of the Spirit, which he would otherwise achieve in other ways. So it's not a necessary thing, but he works that way and brings into our good.
So yes.
For the good of those who believe in him.
I would absolutely agree that God works in our lives in suffering. Let me put it this way. God can work in our lives when we suffer for just living in a fallen world, but it's not guaranteed. It requires some response on my part, that I'm going to look to the grace of God. If I choose not to look to the grace of God, then it won't be accomplished in my life.
Yeah, but that's implied in this for those who love him. Although we are, even as Christians, we are tempted to...
I think what's happening here is that you're kind of mixing the categories, and we can say that is as Romans 8:28 is used in the evil theodicy discussion, which says that God requires that to be, he allowed it, he was requiring that in my life to bring about this good, as opposed to what you are saying, God, we are not denying that in our suffering, God cannot bring about, God may bring about, well, isn't that what Romans, well, let me see, Romans 5, let's see how good I can do with this, what's Romans 5 start with? Romans 5:1. Therefore, being justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, by whom also we have access into this grace when we stand and do rejoice in the hope of the glory of God. And not only this, but we glory in what? In tribulation, for tribulation worketh patience, and patience experience, and experience hope, and hope maketh not ashamed. For the love of God is shed abroad in our hearts by the Holy Spirit, who was given unto us. I think that's true. Tribulation, whether it comes by way of righteousness or unrighteousness, just because I live in a fallen world, can that be used in my life to work patience in my life? Yes. You know, a naughty neighbor who just is just a miserable person to live next to. That can be something that God can use in my life to mature me spiritually.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what you said. He can if we don't reject it, actually.
Right.
Yeah. Can I just say, are you saying then in Romans 5, we have the resource then to deal with just the general evil of the world and maybe the trials, but Romans 8 is more specifically focused on trials we have. I've come to that point in Romans 8 myself.
Okay.
Recently.
All right.
So that's helpful about Romans 5.
Good. No, not good that you've come to the same position that I have, though that makes more a better friendship, you know. Now, let me just deal with one other issue that is one, I think, maybe one of the more difficult questions. Someone says, okay, I understand what you've said here. I understand that this whole thing gives man power of choice. Yeah, that makes sense to me. Well, I'm just making it up, see? Because I like to have people agree with me. This all makes sense to me. But isn't it possible that God could protect all of this? You know, man having the power of choice within this range so that he can love God and do good things, etc. But at the same time, couldn't God stop, intervene, and keep the worst of the evil from coming into this world? I find that one to be a difficult one to take on. See? In other words, couldn't God have stopped the Holocaust? Well, I have to say, he could have. He could have, couldn't he? Well, yeah, he did, but not till, you know what, 12, 14 million people are killed. I'm not just talking about Jews.
But the project was to kill them all.
Yes, well, that's right. But for those who suffered in the camps, there's not a whole lot there. Okay, right. Now, here's what my argument would be. Well, what do we do here? We just keep going around? Well, I guess I just don't.
That's your answer.
And that's my answer. Da Vinci, the Da Vinci Code. Here's what I would. Here's the only way I've learned. The only way I've learned, or attempted to argue this, and quite frankly, no one has been able to rebut it. I'm not saying you can't. I'm only saying it hasn't been. Let's say that X is a minimal evil, okay? And X plus 5 is the worst evil you can imagine. All right? This is outer limit. It is the worst that you can. So I've made a small continuum here for speed time we have. Now, how do I know that one evil is worse than another evil? Well, I mean, it's a comparative thing, isn't it?
By the consequences.
Yeah, exactly. If we compare the consequences, right? I say, you losing both of your legs, both of your eyes, and both of your ears is worse than me getting a scratch on my arm. Yeah, the consequences, all right? So, now let's see what the argument is. That God could stop the worst of evils. Now, what would this lead to? Well, now, if God stopped, prevented, the worst of evils, then that means that evil would never appear in human history, right? This is not about letting it go and then God intervening and wiping it out. This is it never happening in the first place, okay? So, we suggest, all right, so... But what if God did wipe out that evil? Now what would be the worst evil in my experience? X plus 4. And you get what's going to happen here. So what? Let's suppose that X plus 4, this wicked evil, never happened. Exactly. That's precisely where it ends up. We end up where there is no evil. Absolutely.
In my experience, the person who complains the most about, you know, why doesn't God stop all the murders? Then you come back and then you say, well, that would mean God would have to stop your freedom to be angry with your neighbor. And
yeah.
I say, well, I don't
Yeah. The idea is, in part, this idea about losing their freedom. And I think that's a good argument. But what this argument would say is that God can keep freedom intact, but just simply keep the outer limits of the evil out of the way. But your point about this matter of evil is a good response to people. You know, you don't want that evil to happen. So why do you want God to take away that person's free choice? So I guess you don't want free choice either. Seems to me you only can have it one way. Either everybody gets it or nobody gets it. And we do prize power of choice, do we not? As humans, when you want to punish somebody, what do? Take away their freedoms. What do parents do? You're grounded. You cannot go with your friends for 3 weeks. You cannot speak on the phone. Go to your room. When we want to do it to criminals, what do? We take away their freedoms, right? That's how important freedom is to humanity. I think it's part and parcel of who we are as human beings. And that's what, in part, makes us in the image of God. It's a very wonderful thing, but does it not also bear with it a tremendous responsibility? Several years ago, when I was pastoring, there was a family that came from came from an Eastern European country. And he was a geneticist. And he brought his family over, and our church got involved with this family. They were atheist, but my church got involved with this family and actually brought them to church. So one day, one of the ladies in our church took this lady shopping. It was her first time ever to step into a supermarket in the Western world. And she made a comment that was reported to me that I've never forgotten. She understood something so profound that we do not. She walked in, and this was her response. My, so many choices. Americans must be very moral people to have all these choices. That is just a profound statement, isn't it? She understood, thank you, she understood, right, that to have a choice brought with it great moral obligation. That you weren't just free, well, you, I suppose you could choose. Well, there's so many things to talk about. I'm not saying you must do this. I'm just saying if you want to get the whole thing, I do have a book. I don't bring any. I don't sell them. I'm just telling you that it is called A Creation Order Theodicy, God in Gratuitous Evil, published by University Press in January of this year. But if nothing more, you don't have to accept everything, but I hope it gives you some thoughts that maybe to rethink about how we would see the problem of evil, the theodicy, and are we really obligated to point out where the good always? And I say, no, I don't think I'm always obligated.
Thank you.
How would you continue on this? Why think this life should be better if there is no God?
Yes.
I just wonder if it is not like shooting one's feet, you know.
Okay.
One feet, you know. So maybe you could just move it.
Yes. Here's my point with this. I say to somebody, where did you get the notion that something should be better than this? This is all you've ever known. Where did you get the idea that something better could exist? And then I argue, where do you think that notion came from? It doesn't come from your experience. You must have some kind of intrinsic idea that things could be better. Inside of you, where did that come from? And you'd be surprised, all of a sudden people start thinking, yeah, why am I talking about better? Where do I get the concept that they could? Where do I get the concept of something that's ideal? I think that's what leads back to God.
But like many secular people are not not surprised that things happen.
Yes.
They just when the talk comes to God, they would say, okay, I mean, if there was a good and sovereign and omnipotent and omniscient God. Okay, like Dawkins, for example, yeah. He doesn't expect the world to be different than
yes.
He is just, yeah.
And that's why I think that still, though we've just covered it briefly, the greater good theodicy gets us out of this having to defend the idea that a good God necessarily must have a world that's working with no difficulties in it. Mm-hmm. Basically based on this concept of order. And I think, to me, that gets us, so to speak, off the hook. And I've used this in debating with atheists, and there's no real response to this. Because they always want to get me to say, where's the good? Show me the good. And I say, why should I show you the good? Who's claiming it's there? I didn't make that claim, so why am I bound to prove it? And it just frustrates them. Because they're always thinking, well, the last Christian I spoke to made that claim. Well, I'm sorry, I'm not making that claim. Yeah.
When you talk about like what you're just saying now, when you talk about trying to make it to the ideal, and how to have a concept of what is better and all everything like that, it seems to me like it would be an easy objection to that, taking like a view like Hume took or described of the unicorn, where you take the horse, and so you have something like, for instance, you have 1 year in your life where you suffer a lot, you have a car accident, you have whatever, and you have another year where you don't have anything, so that like the second year, which is better, that's your idea of better, which is less suffering. So then you just take that and extrapolate that and say, well, we could have an ideal, just like I mean, all the contentions against God, man, magnified.
Yeah, what I would argue for there is more this notion, why do you have the longing to have it better? Why aren't you satisfied with what is? Now, understand that these are only points. They don't work with everybody. And when I deal with the unbeliever or the atheist, you're just finding a point at which you can connect with this person. And this is just one way in which, and I would agree, it may not be effective for everybody, but often starting in this way forces the individual to think, why is it that I have this notion? Even if I have a bad year last year and a good year this year, that's strictly a comparative issue. Then are you satisfied? Would you be totally satisfied with this year? Get nothing better? Well, no. Then I don't understand how you have a vision of something better when you've never seen it. So it's primarily just to get people to think about these issues. When you deal with it at this level, I'm the first one to admit, this doesn't, you know, while I give a, which I think the theodicy answers the questions that are going to be directed towards me, in talking with some of these people and questions that they have that are, that spin off this, it's not a sure thing. But these are just some things that I might do. And it might be totally worthless with one person. You know, maybe even the person that you are speaking of with Hume. And then I would just move around to something else. I was on a plane a while ago, and I think I was going to Amsterdam, and I sat down beside a lady, and she was reading Ayn Rand, which is a Russian author, and it was Atlas Shrugged, and I said, oh, I see you're reading, and she said, yeah, and then she said to me, have you ever read anything by this author? And I said, yeah. She said, well, what book did you read? And I said, Objectivist Epistemology. And she looked at me. And she said, and what do you do? Yeah. And, you know, I'm always a little resistant to say, not because I'm ashamed, but because I'm always thinking they're going to hit the button for the attendant to come. I want to change my seat. So I said, I teach a philosophy of religion at a seminary. And this was her response. Am I glad that you're sitting beside me? I have a lot of questions. I reached up and hit the button. But she was a Mormon who had left Mormonism and gone into New Age. And I tried to work with her, and I tried all my different approaches, right? I got nowhere. It was like trying to make Jell-O stick to the wall. I mean, it just got nowhere. And so, Lord, you know, what do I do? I'm thinking, Lord, what do I do? So she was about my age, so I thought, well, you know, do you have grandchildren? She was saying everybody's morality was the same. Everybody's morality. I mean, everybody's morality is good for them. You shouldn't try to force your morality on anybody else because different kinds of morality work for different people. So I said, are you a grandparent? Oh, she said, yes, I am. I'm a grandparent. I have two grandchildren. Oh, but she said, it's such a sad case. And I said, a sad case? I'm sorry to hear this. And she said, yes. She said, my daughter, she's just not raising the grandchildren right. And she said, I'm constantly having to go over there and to try to teach these children how to live right. I said, ma'am, I'm quite concerned about you. Why are you going about harassing your grandchildren with your morality? You just told me that everybody's morality was good for them. Let them have it. And we discussed that for about 5 minutes, and then there was dead silence. And she looked at me and she said, I can't have it both ways, can I? I said, no. I said, no, dear, you can't. Just to illustrate, that person, you know, I had gone different ways to try to get to that person, and I couldn't find anything. I'm only suggesting that this might be one way that we can work with the unbeliever. But, boy, I'm now, when I first started doing this, I thought, you know, it's like the hat that you buy at Kmart, one size fits all. But it's not. You just have to have wisdom. It's the Spirit of God. Sometimes it's enough to just catch somebody and they say, yeah, I never thought about that. there's somebody else who's a little sharper maybe and says, but what about this? This doesn't convince me. Then you move to something else. But your question is very on point. I would agree with you. I'm not suggesting that this is the whole ball of wax. Just have wisdom, folks. I'm telling you, it's amazing. And you say, I say, well, this is God, because I didn't come up with that on my own. I don't know. Anyway, all right, tell the lady to come in. You got to, please, I know you got to fill out more forms, but if you'll do it, please. Would you let that lady come in? She just came through the door, and I said, ma'am, where did she go? Yeah, she said in five she had to fill out forms.
I was waiting.
Sure.
I have one question. Like